you while we're doing it Saturday. Yep, I got you. All right. Hi, Dave.
All right. I guess we're just going to jump into presentations.
Okay.
All right.
They're out there waiting, I'm sure.
They are.
He might be getting badged down there.
Yeah, they were checking his shoes.
Checking his shoes off.
Taking his shoes off.
Did you guys bring the dog out?
Yeah.
I'm just going in here to do a presentation.
Thanks, Lori.
So you have a real estate book from me. You have their presentations, but you have a book from me on the real estate presentations. And this will compare them all, so it should say real estate manager search on the front. And this is a way for you to see all of them stacked up next to each other. So the pages under tab one. Under tab one will show you the three candidates and then them next to each other. So like pages 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 will show you their fees, which Arnie's always very keen on their fees next to each other, their different funds next to each other, comparison of them. And then sort of the later pages, it's each individual manager. And you'll see in those sections we have an opinion. And so sometimes while they're in here, if you haven't got a chance to read this ahead of time, you can read the opinions, and it might give you something that we, you know, thought was interesting if you want to ask them a question about any of those things. But we give you the opinion on their performance, an opinion on their process, their operations, their strategy in general for each of the managers. Now, these are all recommended managers by Siegel, so we take a really large list and make it down to what we think are the top three in the industry right now. Westport already manages money for you and has done a good job at that, so they're here to present a different fund or maybe a follow-on investment. We're looking for between $4 and $5 million today to invest. And that's because your real estate allocation is below its target, and we want to keep it at its target. And that's just a summary, and I'll go get them unless there's questions. Okay.
No, so Lee's out sick, and I want to bring that up because he doesn't have a succession plan. Mm-hmm. So I want to bring that up also. If you see, I have just put on, I want to start doing, you know, performance evaluation on our people that we have. I mean, not just picking on Lee, but also Rose. I mean, I think she does a great job, but you know, it's like, I think we should have report cards once in a while if they're meeting our expectations or not, you know. It's, so that's why I put it in that we'll talk about that. But I'm thinking,
I don't think
you know,
I'm stuck grading board members.
You're here on a voluntary case.
We're just thankful that you keep showing up.
Yeah.
That's what I'm starting to tell them at work. I'm just one bad meeting away from calling it quits.
Good morning. Good morning. How is everyone?
All right. So, great. I think it's great to be in that position finally.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I'm Joel.
So you have about 20 minutes for presentation, about 10 minutes for questions. So
great.
Feel free.
Well, I will not waste any time. First, I want to thank you for allowing us to present. Happy to be here and represent Aries. And I'll tell you that I'm more of an executor. I'm not the marketing guy, so I may not be as smooth as some of the people that come in here, but I am the one that actually executes this and work on the team. And Julie Solomon from our firm asked that I do this just because it felt like having the kind of the real world background and experience might be more beneficial. So my name is Joe Hill. I've worked with the firm for about 22 years. I have a number of functions, but really including transactional functions as well as asset management. So both buy the assets, work the assets through the execution of the business plan, finance the assets, and sell the assets. So being mindful of the time, I will work through fairly quickly. I'm not going to hit every page, obviously. If there's anything that you want to hit while we're on that topic, feel free to interrupt, slow me down, ask questions, and certainly we can have questions at the end as well. But as a very brief background on page 4, we are here to speak about Aries Fund 9. It's the ninth in a series of what we would call value-add funds, so a moderate level of risk and moderate return within the real estate spectrum. We are intending to raise $1 billion for the fund. We've had one close to date. First close, we raised $415 million. That closed in May of this year, and we are hopeful to hit our target and have our final close toward the end of this year. And you know, as we turn through the pages, I won't spend time here, but really want to tell you about the team that will execute the strategy, a little bit about our track record, which I think is important, what our strategy is for investment, and why we believe there's an opportunity today. Skipping to page six, Ares is an alternatives manager, and we are about $107 billion worth of assets that we manage on behalf of institutional investors, primarily some publicly traded vehicles, but a lot of institutional type products. Real estate is about $10 billion of that, so roughly 10% of our business is real estate. The rest is other things that I won't speak about today, but a lot of credit where we're doing lending to companies and then some ownership of companies as well. But I really won't spend a lot of time other than how it benefits us as real estate. And we'll talk a bit about that in a moment. Within real estate, we're fairly straightforward. We do primarily buying, owning, so equity investments. But we also have a lending group, which I think separates us a little bit in that we're dealing with borrowers and other market participants from the lending side, so kind of a little bit of a different perspective there. We invest primarily in the major property sectors, whether it be in the U.S. and or in Europe. We do lending in the U.S. and equity in the U.S. We do equity only in Europe. So from our organization, we have about 65 professionals and another 30 or so that support the overall organization, so about 95 professionals work in the real estate group. I sit in Atlanta. We have a large team in Atlanta. We have a fairly large team in New York executing our particular strategy, and then there's a handful of folks that are located outside of those cities. We have been investing since 93, and I think that's a, back to the lineage of the organization, I think that's one of the keys, and we'll talk a bit about the team and the history and why I think that's important. Turning to page eight, really focus on what we believe is sort of our approach to investing. And one of our portfolio manager actually uses an acronym GRI for geography, relationships, and intelligence. You know, everybody has their ways of remembering things, but I think geography is first and foremost on this page. What I hope you will see here with the dots on the map, the different color dots represent the different property sectors, and then of course the different cities and states that we invest in. States are shaded based on how much investment we've had in those. This is only for the value fund. So this is the fund series that we're talking about today. This isn't the lending group. This isn't other more opportunistic strategies. But we have invested $4.2 billion in 190 different investments in more than 80 cities. And you know, we really view ourselves as a multi-property type or asset class and multi-market investor. It's something that we've done throughout our history. It's not something that we entrench to when market conditions get hot in the bigger cities and we go to the smaller markets and sort of buzz in and buzz out. We've really been a part of these markets for a number of years. We consider ourselves more of a middle market investor. We don't invest as much in the gateway cities. We're more of the next tier cities. So we tend to have the lion's share of our investments in cities, depending on the property sector, of $1 million to $2 million and above. So in the U.S., there's 34 cities, I think, that are metropolitan areas that are $2 million and above. There's 53 that are $1 million and above. Those would be typically our targets for multifamily investments and for retail investments. Industrial, it's a little bit different. I'll talk about where our strategy is there. And office, we would tend to be on the larger side of that. So we really want to be in the top 15 to 20 markets for office investments, primarily because the demand for office is much more concentrated And we feel like the capital that wants to come in, once you execute a strategy and buy your asset, when you're ready to sell, is much more concentrated in the larger kind of next tier markets. So specifically, just to give you a flavor of what we buy and what we would buy, what we will be buying in this fund, if you were to invest with us, we are really 75% of our portfolio will likely be in multifamily and industrial sectors is where we anticipate it will shake out. Multifamily, we have a very, I would say, consistent strategy over the last several funds where we're looking to buy assets that are great physical bones in good locations but really need renovations, and be able to come back from where it was positioned when it was developed. It's dropped over time. It needs to have that capital invested to get back to that location. So we really seek to buy existing cash flow, but have a way to enhance that cash flow through, for multifamily renovation. We have a number of assets that we acquired starting coming out of the recession, frankly, when we felt like the demand certainly was not for new home ownership. A lot of folks were forced to go back into the renters. A lot of people, for demographic reasons, for lifestyle choice reasons, prefer to do that. People are more mobile now. So there's a lot of demand factors that are pushing multifamilies to be an attractive sector for us. We felt like buying well-located assets in the markets that we know, we've seen these markets develop over time, right path of growth, right location, find the right assets and renovate the assets. And we're typically achieving 15 to 20% return on investment on the incremental dollars. So the multifamily itself will not produce that kind of return. We're looking to buy a good, stable asset, but be able to invest some incremental money and benefit from that on rents. Fairly simple strategy. Sure, if you talk to other folks, you know, we're not the only people doing it. We do it, we feel like, very well. We have a good track record, and we're still buying as late as the last investments in our current fund. We still find those opportunities out there. It also allows us to not compete with new construction, and you are seeing new construction in some markets in multifamily, probably more than any property sector. You get headline news about multifamily overbuilding in certain markets. We're really focused on different level, different tier of assets that we feel like are a lot more insulated to that.
Can you talk about your, so given that it's going to be $1 billion fund, your deal size is pretty large, so, you know, 50 to whatever, $150 million range. So what does the competition look like in that area for other people bidding on those kind of
Well, for us, we view that, and it's a good question, we view an investment oftentimes to be a multiple property. So we may buy with a, you know, a group that will, that we have history with, multiple properties that fit that specific strategy in certain geographies. So on an individual property, it may be 15 million or 20 million of equity. We do want to buy assets that are large enough to sell for multifamily, not too big, because most of our takeouts are, if you have a well-located renovated property, your buyout, your takeout is oftentimes a private individual who is looking to, you know, hire net worth private individual who's looking to hold that. So we will buy individual assets by aggregating those investments up to a 50 to 100 million in multi. We're not buying the large multi.
Okay.
So the competition is really, you know, there's folks that are similar to us. There's some folks that may be more local, private in nature, but they tend not to be as attracted to the assets that need the type of renovation that we're looking for. We're not looking for a complete wholesale, take a C-minus property to try to make it B-plus. That's not what we're talking about here. We're really talking about it, something that was built as a, you know, an A back in the day. Based on its age, it's probably a, could be an A-minus to a B-plus, and maybe it's just gotten to be a B or a B-minus over time. But it's, when we talk about renovations, we're talking about the same thing people are doing to their houses. It's kitchens, you know, the finishes, the cabinets, the pulls, the light fixtures, the faucets, flooring, and in the bathrooms. And then more importantly, we're doing the common areas, because people use apartments differently today than they did when they were built. So we're, you know, two tennis courts are no longer needed, but we'll use that space for something else. We'll really do a good job on the pool. We'll do business centers. we'll do fitness centers, we'll do package rooms, because everybody's taking packages, you know, getting e-commerce, the old package rooms are not. So it's, that's the kind of stuff that we're doing.
So if that's true that you have, you know, 15 million or 20, I mean, how many properties are within a portfolio?
Well, I mean, in Fund 7, I think we were 96 total properties on a $750 million fund.
75% multifamily.
And industrial is our, where we would expect
and
it to come
industrial.
Out. And industrial, where we would expect it to come out. Industrial, we have liked since, again, this, you know, the seventh fund, just the current, you know, the current team has executed the seventh, eighth, and we'll be doing the ninth fund. You know, e-commerce has really changed the way people are receiving goods. It's changed the location of those goods, and it's changed the type of buildings that fit that strategy. I feel like we were, I don't say we invented it, but we were on the leading edge of that, based on research that we had done. We were investing heavily back in 09, 10, 11. Into that, we continue to find great opportunities. We are, you know, instead of being sort of that million to 2 million ish, it's probably in those similar markets, but it's really, there's certain markets that for either rail, for air facilities, for roadways, or location within the U.S. that really take the lion's share of the demand. And we are focused on those markets. So it may not be markets that we would otherwise invest in, but it would be attractive from an industrial standpoint. So, you know, Indianapolis is the second largest FedEx air hub. It's the domestic headquarters, Memphis being the global headquarters. Those two markets, Louisville with UPS, those are great markets for investment. Columbus, because of the retailers that are there. Those are not markets we necessarily target for office, but they're great top-tier industrial markets, very liquid, a lot of tenant demand and a lot of buyer demand once you execute the strategy.
I'm moving away somewhat from what you were saying, but are you a lender upon sale of your properties?
We are not. We have only equity funds for this fund, so when we sell, we're selling, and then we're distributing those the cash, the proceeds back to our investors. But it's a good question. We have a lending group that lends, but they can't lend to us. We can't buy from them. They don't, you know, separate businesses for fiduciary reasons. But it is useful in that we are in the same markets. We do call on the same people. Sometimes an asset will come in. It may be something we would want to buy. It's maybe not a fit for the buy. It may be something that would be more attractive from the lending side. So you do get that benefit, but you know, we don't do the same deals.
How long do you predict, like, this is Fund 7 or 8? I mean, how long before you start cashing that in? I mean, how long does it take to retrofit these multi-dwellings? And
we usually hold assets on average, and I'm going to just pick a 5 years, kind of a typical. We have assets that we sell in three. We've already sold assets out of Fund 8. Fund 7, we've distributed, you know, what we've raised broad numbers, you know, $750 million. We've already distributed, you know, 1.5.
So you always talk about good. How many failures have you had? How many do you have to hold on to for a long time, or there are losses?
We don't have any losses. We certainly were not, you know, we're not perfect, and we've had things that didn't come like we thought. I'll say in Fund 7, I would say the one that we just didn't predict correctly is we raised that money prior to the Great Recession. You know, a lot of folks that were in our same space got in a lot of trouble. They invested the money, they lost some or all of their money.
Yeah.
We're going to have a very great story. We think we'll double the investor's money on gross basis. We're going to get 2.0 multiple, equity multiple, top almost 20% IRR. Yes, timing helped us because we invested coming out of the recession, but we also had the ability to invest going into it. You know, we put our pencils down for over a year and didn't invest. What we missed a bit is there was a hotel opportunity that we liked, the fundamentals of the hotel. The market looked like it was coming out of the recession, was kind of coming up, and then it had another fall. So we won't, you know, we won't lose money on the hotel, we don't think. We've executed the strategy, we pulled back the strategy as the market conditions changed. it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to do what we thought it would do. We thought it would be a, you know, a great fit for this. We think it would just be, you know, okay. Not even okay for us. It's not going to meet our, it's not going to meet our goals, but it will be fine. On the multifamily, you know, we did have the wind in our sails, but we have done very well. A lot of what we've returned has been over 20%, because we're not just buying something and sort of waiting on the market to do something or hoping the economy comes back. We're really creating value by fixing 300-unit apartment complex a unit at a time. And, you know, sort of, you know, with us, that plan, sometimes you slow it down a little bit if the market conditions aren't absorbing. You speed it up a little bit. Sometimes you downgrade. Sometimes you upgrade. By and large, we've both sped it up and we've upgraded what we've done. We plan to do $7,000 a unit. We feel like the market really wants a little higher standard. We want to put $9,000 a unit. Totally speaking, that not all inside the unit. Some of it's the common space, common areas. But, you know, relatively speaking, it might be 10% of the value, maybe 15% of the value of the units going back in. So we're not completely putting 50% back in. We're not completely redoing, rebuilding. We're just on the margin improving. And then going back to where we think we'll invest the money, the other balance, call it, you know, 25%, probably split between office and retail. Our retail is very specific. You know, there's a lot of headline news in retail, and we're certainly very aware of that and have been for a long time. We've been concerned about the way goods are getting to the consumer is benefiting us in industrial, creates risk in retail, broadly speaking. We are convenience-oriented retail, so necessity-based retail. We are largely grocery-anchored with other necessary tenants, so services, goods, exercise, drugstores, things that are not the targets for e-commerce, broadly speaking. And then beyond that, we're certainly looking for the right demographics, the right location, right side of the road, on the way home from work, all the fundamental stuff that you do for real estate. Cognizant of time, so I'm going to push through a little quickly. You know, from a team standpoint, on the next page, I think, you know, one of the keys here is I've had the opportunity to work with some great professionals on this page. I think we're a very cohesive team. We've been around, many of us have worked together for 50 to 20 years. We're very investor focused based on just where we come from. That's kind of who we are. And I think collectively we have different backgrounds, but we make great decisions together. We don't always come from the exact same backgrounds, the same experiences, put all that together, and I think we do a good job executing a strategy. So, you know, what you'll see is, you know, as you kind of go down, you'll see lots and lots of years of experience and gray hairs on the mid-level people that are actually not the managers, people are actually executing the strategies. You know, Pat Reagan in the middle and owned his own management firm. He heads up our multifamily asset management. He owned a management company. He's owned properties. He's come back, works for us. You know, outstanding guy, knows people across the board, every way in the market, every shape and form. And then going down, you know, to the next level, you know, we really take pride in developing younger talent. We bring talent in. A lot of our folks that have moved up two or three notches are folks that have been with the company for, you know, for many, many years. So that's kind of the relationship piece. The important there is forgetting how we work together. We've been in the market for a lot of time. We know who owns, we know the managers, we know the attorneys that do a lot of business, we know the title companies. It helps in those markets where we try to do business. And the last is for intelligence. What separates us a bit is, you know, I said I'm not going to talk about what the rest of the company does. It does benefit us in, there's investment in, I believe, 1,300 companies in the country that are in 60 industries. So we have dedicated folks that are both researchers and then beyond that, relationship people who have either, you know, lent money to these companies or owned companies. But if they haven't owned the company, they've owned the competitor, they know the competitor, they research the industry for a lot of people that we touch. And it helps us as risk mitigation in our tenants. It helps us to get special relationships in many cases that we can point to where we either know the industry very well, we know the tenants specifically, we can speak to them. Maybe we don't maybe our tenant is not somebody that they've invested in, they've invested in a competitor. They know the market, and it allows us to get insights that we would not ordinarily be able to achieve. Skipping forward for time, just the way we approach asset value-added investing, and I think I've mentioned this a little bit, probably didn't hit it hard enough, is we really are a cash flow-oriented group. The reason we're buying these cash flows and trying to enhance them is we are very oriented toward distributing cash flow through the process of the ownership of the assets, not waiting to give you your money back after we sell it. So in Fund 8, we haven't even finished making the last investment yet. We've had 15 distributions for $103, I believe there's $105 million that we've already returned to investors. Only two small property sales. Most of that has been cash flow. So we're investing in cash flowing assets. We focus on the cash flow. It's important because it doesn't put all of our eggs at the basket at the end on where the market is and ability to sell. That probably differentiates us more in what we buy and where we buy than a lot of the things. So,
are these portfolios that you put together, or they're sort of out in the market where, you know, you've got?
Largely, we've assembled them. We may buy a small portfolio of maybe, you know, a REIT might be selling two or three assets, but we'll end up buying, you know, we'll buy 20 assets overall. The largest one that we bought was in Fund 7. We started with an industrial portfolio that we recapitalized. I think it was maybe 11 or so properties, but we grew that from, I think that portfolio alone was 3.5 million feet. We grew that to almost 8 million feet. So it represented not quite half. That would be the largest portfolio purchase. We're not out going and buying large portfolios. We buy the portfolios if we like the individual assets, we like the opportunity. Sometimes there's less competition there. We feel like we can get an insight. We're always looking for an edge, either in how we buy it, hopefully, but also how we manage it. Oftentimes the edge may be, there was a case study here, but recapitalization where something was in receivership. It's been in receivership, so by definition, it was a portfolio. It was 28 assets. We decided we liked 8 of them. I think it was. We were only able to buy 6 of them because of the court process. So, you know, we will go and look at that as an edge where we're willing to spend the time on it through a bankruptcy process. The assets have been undercapitalized as a result of it. Great assets, just nobody could spend money on them and operate them correctly.
But typically, you're putting the portfolio together, though, yourself.
We're assembling.
You're sort of looking.
We're assembling, and in industrial, we think it's typically you're assembling to sell as a bulk. You're also mitigating your risk throughout because you're creating diversification within that portfolio. We're assembling really a portfolio of multi, but we're also not planning to sell it as a bulk. We're really planning on the seller selling those one off. Sometimes you're buying a small portfolio and actually selling them individually. So with the receivership, we bought the 6. We've already sold one of those 6. Individual buyer, you know.
So your exits are either selling them together or selling them individually, or is
more,
it
with the exception of industrial, I would say more individually. We don't have a lot of portfolio sales. We're creating individual value and then selling it sometimes to an institution or sometimes to a when I say individual, these are high net worth individuals, but oftentimes for multi, that is your best market. More than a REIT. The REITs can't afford to buy a one-off property.
Okay.
There's not a time.
So you're not selling them to core funds or REIT funds?
Sometimes we are. No, when I say institutions, sometimes they're core advisors. It depends on the property, but we've certainly had a lot of our Florida. We did a fair amount of multifamily in Florida, some in Orlando, some in Tampa, and I would say a good portion of those have gone to what I would call some form of institution, either a REIT or an advisor. Same with Texas. One other thing I'd like to leave you with on this page is we execute these strategies ourselves. We have in-house asset management. Sometimes we may have an operating partner, but we are in there with that operating partner and then other assets we own without an operating partner where we're executing ourselves. So we're not buying a property with a great business plan and paying somebody to execute and hope they execute it well. We're hands-on. We may have a partner that has those great skills and we're alongside that partner. which is important for renovating 300 units, to have people that you can depend on. We've also done the 300 units by ourselves. We can do either way. But we are, in either case, we're right there, understanding the business and understanding execution and creating that all the way through sale.
How about fee structure?
Fee structure, why don't we skip to 53, I think it is. But I appreciate you doing that. It's one of the things I may want to come back to, but be respectful of time. I'll let you guys drive. So the fee structure would reduce the commitment fee in this fund to 0.75 on uncalled capital. It's 1.5 on once it's invested. In terms of the management fee, there's no acquisition fee, there's no disposition fee. So our basically our ongoing fee structure is 0.75 commitment up through when it's divested, then it's 1.5. And then in terms of the distributions, there's a 8% preferred, and then after that there's a split of 60-40 until 20%, so it's somewhat of a similar structure, I guess, is a lot in our space. You know, it's based on actual capital, so it's not a deal by deal. It's on the overall fund investment, so the European style. We think that we will. It's a 3-year investment period from our final closing. Fund life is 8 years in the final closing. Again, each individual asset is usually about 5 years, but kind of giving some time for some that may be a little bit longer. And the general partner, Ares, will invest a minimum of $25 million, and that will come from both the company, but a lot of principals, myself.
Do I see a $10 million minimum?
That's a guideline. It's not a minimum. It says to our discretion. We have actually, our history, we have a lot of experiences with funds, county or city funds that are typically smaller than that. So we have a good history of that. Our investor base in that first close of $415 million, it's, you know, it's a wide variety. It's pension fund, it's offshore financial institutions, if you will, domestic financial institutions. We have Cap Partly plans. Foundations, endowments, so fairly similar to our competitors that I think they are. One other page I'd like to come back to was page 17. This is, you know, the track record that we spoke to. I'm very proud of both funds. Fund 7, it's not all the way done yet, but just to show where we think it will go, we raised $756 million. We've already returned $1.3 billion. We view this as likely to be a 2.0 equity multiple gross, 1.6 net, gross IRR of 20%. And Fund 8, which was a vintage September 13, so the investment's coming really in the end of 13, 14, 15, we feel that that's going to be more of a 15% IRR. We've invested roughly 98% in terms of what's committed in investment committees in closing. So we're almost wrapped with that fund. And we've not yet had a closing on VDF Fund 9. We've had investor closing, not a property closing, but we do have two assets that they're pretty far along that will close, we think, in the third quarter. But just going back on, you know, what we said earlier, you know, 15 distributions, $105 million already for Fund 8, which was formed in 2013 and has yet to invest all its capital. We've had 43 distributions for Fund 7. You know, a lot of those were just cash flow-oriented distributions. Obviously, we've had a lot of property sales. Rose, going back to your question, so I was going on memory, but it was 96 individual properties in 25 investments. So we would consider 25 investments, some being multiple properties. 96 total properties. We've sold of the 96, we've sold 87 of them. And in Fund 8 to date, we've acquired 64 in 15 investments. We've sold two of the properties, which are smaller multifamily.
Can you you just talk about the real estate market in general? A lot of people would say it's overheated, it's not a great time to buy anything.
I can't. I would say it is, you know, there is a lot of headline news that we look at, and I would say there's definitely capital out in the market. We turn over a lot of stones to buy property, and that's what we do and what we've always done. We've never, frankly, ever found it easy to buy property. Page 15 kind of gives you a sense of what we look at versus what we close on, but I would say in the market, we're very selective. We get a lot of our opportunities through areas where we can find an edge. We know the seller, it's a partner that has priced something loose. It's just the not marketed deals. If you, we don't have time to get through case studies today, but a lot of what we acquired were, you know, through estates, through, you know, receivership, through owners that may have taken it back in the last recession, held onto it for a while, really didn't invest in it, buy it back. Those are sort of the opportunities that, you know, the capital that's coming here is not chasing those types of opportunities. They're more looking for the bigger gateway cities. You know, those are the ones where I think there's probably excess capital chasing. Doesn't mean our job is easy. We do a lot of deals. We don't like the pricing on a lot of deals. We like the real estate. We don't like the pricing. We walk away. We're very careful and selective, but we are a value-oriented fund, so we're always focused on the value, the replacement cost, making sure that we're buying at a discount, because we're value guys. We've got to be able to sell, buy at value, but sell at a value. And I think it's also a little bit representative of what we're buying as well, kind of the multifamily. Nobody's building the multifamily. Really, very few people are building the suburbs. That's where our multifamily portfolio is. It's a suburban portfolio. That's where people are growing. You know, again, the press will tell you everybody's moving in town. People are moving in town, but there's also great opportunity in good suburbs, established suburbs. A lot of those suburbs are becoming more walkable, amenities are getting better. That's where we feel the value is. Nobody's building there. And that the value, the price points that we're buying and selling at, nobody can build. Construction costs are high.
If I could ask your educational background and professional experience.
Sure. So this is probably won't go over well in this room, but went to Clemson University. I guess it's not terrible, but not an arch rival, but not a Florida school.
Not FSU.
Yeah, I can't say either one. In Florida, actually, we both have good engineering programs. But I was actually a ceramic engineering background. Graduated in 1995, and I worked for, you know, research development function, and went to got an MBA in real estate at Georgia State University in Atlanta while working, and then transitioned in 95 to Equitable Real Estate, which was the predecessor of the very first value fund. So the company was purchased, we didn't really get to the lineage, but the company has been, this real estate fund series has been ongoing since 93. I joined the firm, not with this fund, but I joined the firm in 95, and then joined this fund series in 2000.
And your involvement, actual day-to-day involvement?
Day-to-day, we tend to stick with the assets we acquire. So I work on finding new investments, but a lot of what I do is asset management, meaning executing the business plans of assets that we've acquired. I have a special history, I guess, in our firm and office. We have certain people that have more history in one place than the other. So I tend to be more of the office expert, but I manage assets and acquire assets. And managing really means financing, refinancing, and selling as well. We kind of do it all. So my day-to-day, I spend a lot of time on leasing assets. For office, we're trying to spend less capital. We're not doing the multifamily program where we're trying to completely redo an office. It takes a lot of capital. We're trying to pass capital through distributions. We're trying to bring this cash flow. So I do a lot of time on leasing and then sales of assets once we execute a business plan. We don't fall in love with our assets. We're ready to move it out and return the capital. So right now, I've got an asset, three assets that are closing in Washington, D.C. market, suburban Virginia, but DC broadly speaking tomorrow, and spent last Thursday and Friday underwriting a new acquisition for Fund 9, office acquisition in Chicago, and really feet on the ground and walking the competitive buildings, speaking to all the folks in the market, touring the tenant spaces and the back of the house, HVAC, all the good stuff.
Anyone else with questions? Joe, thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you. Appreciate the opportunity. I really do. It's fun to do this part of the business because investors are our most important component to keep us going. You know, it's great. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If there's anything that you can help with a follow up, please feel free to reach out. I know you will.
Thank you.
Thank you guys. Bye bye.
Are you ready for the next person?
Sure.
All right.
Just keep it going.
Keep it going.
Cindy's falling asleep. She's been traveling this week.
I'm working on 3 hours. Not good.
Why that school?
The graduate program that they have there, she's interested in. So her list of schools is on, but it's, Masters of Public Health with a concentration in infectious diseases epidemiology.
That's weird. That's a weird combination.
How aggressive all that is?
But she loves science and math, and she doesn't want to touch people. So
kind of that part, yeah.
Doesn't like people, is that what you said?
Yeah. She's an introvert all day long.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I can smoke all day.
So we're going to do about 20 minutes for your presentation, about 10 minutes for questions, and the floor is yours.
Okay, well, put my watch in front of me, make sure I don't go over. Well, let me just start by saying good morning. My name is Alistair Cripps. I'm with Mesereau Financial. I run our institutional real estate practice. I'm also a member of our firm's board of directors. Thank you very much for the time and for allowing us to present today. A little bit about our firm, Mesereau Financial, on page 4. If you're not familiar with it, we're an independent and employee-owned firm. We have approximately 600 employees, and more importantly, we have 250 owners of the firm, including myself. Our largest owner is our chairman, who is approximately 7%, so it's very widely held. So when we say Mesereau Financial is investing, it is the employees' money that is invested. We're an 80-year-old firm. We just celebrated our 80th anniversary a couple of months ago. In terms of where we're headquartered in Chicago, Illinois. We have offices in Hong Kong and London, and we have numerous offices throughout the state of, throughout the United States, including two here in Florida and Miami, as well as Boca. Unfortunately, real estate's not here in Florida. I wouldn't mind that, to be honest with you. And then lastly, in terms of the firm, we have two divisions. One's our global markets division, which is fixed income and trading, a little investment banking, sale-leaseback, and then we have our investment management division, which is primarily focused on alternatives. We have approximately $33 billion under management as of June 30th. And the last thing that I would say, we have a currency platform of about $70 billion under management. If we could turn to page 5. We're here to talk to you about our third fund, Mesereau Financial Real Estate Value Fund 3. We are targeting $750 million with a focus on the U.S. apartment sector. We're about a third of the way through fundraising as we speak. We have firm commitments of $291 million and have closed on $231 million. We have 16 investors to date. 13 re-ups from previous funds and 3 new investors. What I can tell you is our pipeline of investors and re-up presentations is very strong right now. In terms of our target returns, we're targeting 11 to 13% net of all fees. Talk about our track record first and foremost. I think it's probably the most important thing here. Our first fund was a 2011 vintage fund. We raised approximately $380 million from 19 institutional investors. We purchased 22 investments in 14 markets around the United States. We have since sold 10 of the 22. Our realizations are about 21.25% on a gross basis. There's a detail on page 44 of each of those if you have the time. I think most importantly, though, is the current income that our funds, even though we're closed-end fund, current income tax flow, we're generally between 6 and 7% net of fees paid quarterly. We haven't missed a dividend, and we've been out of the J-curve on both of our first two funds, and we anticipate for our third fund before our file flows, given the cash flow nature of the business that we're in. Our second fund, which is a 2014 fund, performance, again, has been strong, 11.63% net. We've made 17 investments. Seven of the 17 are being held at cost, and we'll see some good write-ups at year end, so that number we expect to rise. In terms of cash flow, as we ramp up in the fund investing, as you can see what Fund 3 might do, we're about 3.2%, a little under 3.2% net of fees in 2016. We anticipate about 4.5% today as we get a fund of our development projects, which are not income producing, stabilized. We expect that once it's stabilized, 6 to 7%. So ultimately, we're looking for current income to be almost 50% of our fund once we're up and running. In terms of our third fund, we have made one investment, which I'll talk about later, and we're very close on another two. And so we see income coming in already from our first investment, which is in Southern California. In terms of experience on the team, 26 years experience, but I think more importantly, myself, my co-CIO with myself, Charlie Kendrick and Guy Chirillo, we've been working together for almost 20 years, including the last decade here at Mesro Financial. In terms of alignments of interest, which I think are important, Mesro Financial, in our third fund, we'll be putting $10 million co-investment, and then the team on top of that will be putting north of $3 million. Myself and the chairman of Mesro Financial are the two largest investors in our team sidecar fund. So everybody on the team is writing checks for every investment we make, which I think is very powerful. If you turn to page 6 and 7, there's just a quick snapshot of our team. As I mentioned, you can see the senior managing folks on the team, myself and Charlie, Guy, and Ben, John, and Brian on the team. We have additional outside members of our team on the investment committee, and then additional folks on page 7 as we've grown sets of team. What the pages don't show you is we have another 40-plus people at Mesro Financial in the infrastructure area. So we have accounting, we have IT, everybody's favorite, legal and compliance. So there's another 40 folks that have some percent of their time that we work with. If we could turn to page 10, talk a little bit about Fund 3 specifically. Now, this is our third fund. Our focus is on the U.S. apartment sector and the top 25 to 30 metro areas. There's a terrific map on page 15 that I do want to spend some time on just to show you where our investments are. Today, the apartment sector continues to have terrific fundamentals. There's a vacancy rate of 4.4% as of June 30th. Again, there'll be metro area by metro area on page 15. And demographic drivers continue to be off the charts and very positive, which I'll touch on in a minute. And supply not meeting demand in many markets, a few exceptions to that, like Houston, for example. Now, our fund is a value-added fund. So our primary strategy, about 70% of what we do, is to buy existing product and reposition that asset through better property management and more capital expenditures. So first thing we do on the interiors, we do nicer finishes. So we do cabinets, cabinet fronts, we do flooring, we do backsplash, we do lighting. A lot of those have two functions. One is higher rents from the residents, better quality. But sometimes when you're putting in LED lighting and you're putting in vinyl plank flooring, for example, you're cutting down the repairs and maintenance costs over time as well. So you're not replacing carpeting, for example, every 4 years or even five, and if it's heavy student property, it's probably more like three years. So, and then the second thing that we do on the common areas is the amenities. So for example, we'll do dog parks, we'll enhance fitness facilities, we'll add package concierge. So if you think about the internet today with packaging systems, it's all automated. So you come in and the leasing team doesn't have to be, in essence, taking and giving packages that allows them to rent units. So those are the type of things that we like to do on the common areas. And I think by putting in this new capital, when we get ready to sell the project, particularly about 70% of what we do, it allows us to sell a lot of times to core buyers and publicly traded REITs. So we've had that success in terms of what we're doing. You know, we sold a property a couple of weeks ago to LaSalle's Income Fund, for example, which is a large core fund. And then our secondary strategy, which in our two first funds, we have about 17% of commitments, so just so you can put the risk perspective, is the ground-up development where we partner with a joint venture development partner. We're doing best-in-class operators, and we primarily have targeted the West Coast. We've done a couple of transactions here, Amazon's corporate headquarters in Seattle, downtown San Diego. We have one under construction in Orange County with a Whole Foods, right, I guess you could say Amazon Foods today, right across the street. Actually, our one outlier happens to be in your state here in Florida. We have one in Midtown Miami in the design Wynwood area at 29th and 2nd. We're building a high-rise there that will be delivered next March. So we're well underway there. So but primarily, that's what our development strategy is with a partner. In terms of the fund, it is a closed-end fund. It typically, our investments are 3 to 6 years per fund. Per strategy, if you will. As an example, in our first fund, we've returned almost all of the original commitments in the first 6 years. A lot of that's through cash flow, and a lot of it's through the realizations. When you look at the realizations, you'll see, you know, the day we acquired it and the day we sold it. So typically, our investment period is 3 years, so we'll radically invest over a three-year period. We don't want to put all our money out. Market conditions change, I think. With our research, some of the markets we invest in will kind of be more cyclical in that nature. And then with a five-year investment period. So it's an eight-year harvest, but I would tell you typically it's a 3 to 6 year hold per investment. And then lastly, geographic focus. We are nationwide. As I'm the portfolio manager, I can tell you that my biases continue to be the West Coast and the South and Southeast. And it's purely based on two things, population growth and jobs. We the people are what are the demand drivers for real estate. Again, our target return 11 to 13% net. And as I mentioned earlier, we have made one investment. We closed last month. It's a 270 unit project in Ranch Cucamonga, which is right on the, I guess you could say, the west side of Orange County, just outside of Orange County. Probably the tightest market in the country. It's got about a 2.8% vacancy rate. So it was a heavy end of the housing crash, and nothing's been built there in a while. We're very close to putting under contract a second investment in downtown Dallas that we're pretty excited about. And then we're nibbling on a potential development opportunity in Phoenix that we're excited about. So that's kind of our short-term, what I would say are more advanced investment opportunities. Are there any questions on that? If I could ask you to turn to page 12, I want to try and go over this pretty quick, but I could spend all day on this because it's somewhat of a research geek. But, really, why our strategy? Why us? Why now? Why Mesro, so to speak? You know, our focus is apartments, so much like people need to eat, they need a place to live. Start with apartment fundamentals. National vacancy rate 4.4%. It's held pretty steady the last 2 to 3 years, despite supply certainly 3.5 times what it was during the lull of the recession, if you will, global financial crisis. So starting with population growth, we have 321 million people here in the U.S. We get about 3.5 million per year. 2.2 to 2.4 is birth less deaths, and up to 1.2 million is in immigration. And that's legal. Now, obviously, this is a very hot topic today in immigration, but I think understanding immigration is really important. Two-thirds of all immigrants live in six states when they come here, including Florida, and they typically rent for the first 5 years. So I think it's important to know that that also continues to be a strong demand driver. Probably the most important demand driver, though, is, I'm guessing by some of your ages here, the millennials, your kids. We're in year four of a 12-year run where we're going from 62 million to almost 80 million 18 to 24 and 25 to 34 year olds. So we're in year four here, so we're around 68 million today. So we've got quite a runway here left in terms of the growth that we see on that and why that's important. Very high propensity to rent. The other thing to talk about is home ownership. If you look back at U.S. home ownership, we're today at about 63.5%. We're dead smack in the long-term average from about 1958 to about 1998. We kind of went up 69.2, fourth quarter of 2004, we started this decade at 67% homeownership. Each 0.1% decline we've had, we've had the biggest move in homeownership declines in the U.S. since 2010. So think about the global financial crisis. Each 0.1% represents 130,000 households back in the rentership pool. So we created, just in homeownership declines, about 5 million rentership. We actually are in an inventory shortage in apartments as well as single family housing right now. So you can't talk about one without the other. And then the last thing that I would say is, you know, this continues to be an issue, is kids under the age of 35 living at home with mom and dad. So maybe I'll see some smiles here, maybe I won't.
Wait, we're calling 35-year-olds kids?
Yeah, no doubt, right?
Well, when they come back home, you got to call them kids.
Yeah. Well, I don't think they're ever not your kids, right? I mean, depending on the age. But we were about 26% living at home, kind of right around the front end of the financial crisis. We peaked at 35, we're about 31. So it's slowly reversing its trend. So, you know, I think mom and dad want them out of the house as much as anybody. But really, I think when you look at what's happening, particularly on two fronts, is the personal credit. So if you think about the credit scores for first-time home buyers today, and buying single family, it's 763. 2007 was 704. So the banks have made it much more difficult for first-time home buyers. Home builders have been kind of largely ignoring that starter home. They've been kind of doing that 300 to 600. And I think in many, many markets, you're seeing a lot of the inventory in that kind of price range just get snapped up because there's not enough of it. So when you talk about demand drivers, they're not going anywhere anytime fast. But if I could ask you to turn to page 13 really quick to talk about supply. You can see that we're up. The top chart there on the right, we're up about 3.5 times on the supply side, and I think there's a lot of headline. I know a lot of apartments have been built. Well, guess what? We're only just over the long-term average from about 1994 to about 2008. We're maybe 10% higher. We'd have to go for another decade at these levels just to catch up from the global financial crisis underbuilding. So, and keep that in mind. We're 250 million people back in 1995. Today we're 320. So in theory, this should be growing at the rate of population growth, but it really hasn't. So we feel like this is a very, we want to be the very steady Eddie. We're really the tortoise in the tortoise and hare race in this strategy is how I would look at it. On page 15, I had commented earlier, what I would show you here is you can see our investments we've made by fund. Fund 1, 2, and 3, although that green for Fund 3 is a little harder to tell. So it's a national platform that we have. Certainly market rotation continues to be important with our research. Here in your state of Florida, we've got several investments in Orlando, one in downtown St. Pete, could be my favorite spot here in the state, one in Delray, and we have one under construction in Miami. If I could ask you to jump ahead to page 20, and then ultimately 23 and 22, I just want to show you kind of what we do more from a picture standpoint than anything else. If you turn to page 23, this was an asset that we bought in the northern suburbs of Chicago across the street from the metro station. We bought it from Morgan Stanley. This is what we did on page 24. We're not kicking anybody out. They notice us, we come in, we do measurements, appliance, flooring, countertops, new cabinetry in this case. You're going to get a different answer from us depending on the investment. On page 22, we tore down the clubhouse, we rebuilt it. Basically what we had was two giant leasing offices, two giant bathrooms, and a pool behind it. So what we did is we right-sized the bathrooms and the leasing offices. We added a fitness facility. We added kind of a Wi-Fi cafe. We could sit down, get free Wi-Fi, have a cup of coffee. We wound up selling this to a publicly traded REIT at the end of last year. We held it for about 5 years. IRR on this is about 18.6, but more importantly, how I look at things is really the equity multiple. You know, IRRs are IRRs. It's money that you need in cash. So. Really, the equity multiple is more important to me than the IRR. Second example, what we'll call a light value add, is this is an asset we bought from CalSTRS in downtown St. Pete. It's right across the front of the street from the Nobody Goes to Devil Ray games. So, sorry if I'm insulting anybody here. we didn't do anything to the units. Units, you can see a small picture on page 25. We didn't touch the units. This was our 28 as well. This was really more of a common area repositioning, better management of the property. The Kelsters had a, was the seller, had three property managers, property manager that only had three assets on the East Coast. And so they weren't getting the operating leverage. We brought in Ram Partners out of Atlanta. They had 6,000 units just in the campus, six people area alone. They were running it at 98% occupancy. The first year we were up 17% in rents, just running at a normal vacancy rate, which is about 5%. We did a full LED conversion on the entire parking structure, took out all the fluorescents in the common areas. We increased parking by 50 to 100% because there's nowhere else to park. They had some ground floor retail. They had it in raw space. Didn't even have a leasing broker, which is kind of shocking. We put in a nice, you know, hair salon spa, you know, a little higher end, added about $50,000 bottom line just for that. Net, we're up about $1.1 million in 24 months. Never really seen anything like that in my career, quite honestly. And this is just the management and, you know, redoing the amenity areas.
I'm familiar with the property. It's a good looking property.
It is, isn't that? And we did, and first thing we did was picnic because, you know, we've got salt air that's corrosive, right? So it's the first thing that we did. Last thing I'll just comment on is, you know, a ground-up development. Just an example on page 32. If you look at the pictures, 33, 34, 35. I mean, this is good-looking product. We built this for $69 million. We sold this last year to Essex, a publicly traded REIT, for $97 million. We had a 20 IRR, 1.85 equity multiple. Again, this is the highest risk that we have in the portfolio, which I mentioned earlier, was about 17%. Our student comments, and you see a little bit of student, it's not your typical heads on bed strategy. It's more just when we find market rate apartments with heavy student profile. It's really the same analysis that you'll see in 38, 39, just kind of before and after. But again, a little different finish level because it's going to get beat up quite a bit from the student population. Just wrap it up here. Just a quick comment on two things before I go to fees. On page 42, just want to talk about our portfolio risk. Certainly answer any questions. I'll give you kind of what we did on Fund 1. We replicated on Fund 2, and we're obviously in the process of starting on Fund 3. Fund 1, 22 investments, 14 geographic markets, so geographic diversification, 11 urban investments, 11 suburban investments, although our suburban is more transit-based, so 6 of our 11 were transit. So we had light rail in Portland, we had Red Line Metro Stop in D.C., we had two across the street from PATH locations in northern New Jersey, which is kind of the rail, one stop into Secaucus Junction and a second into from downtown Rutherford. We have product diversification, so what I mean by that is high-rise, mid-rise, both wraparound garage as well as podium, and then lastly, the two-story garden style walk-up that a lot of us are familiar with. The other thing that we did was vintage year diversification, so our first one we did 1980s, 1990s, 2000, 2010 vintage year. I would tell you that we are no longer doing 80s vintage. We didn't in Fund 2 and we're not in Fund 3. I'm looking at the exit strategy and who the potential buyers were, and there's some functional obsolescence with the ceiling heights and everything else. Our true sweet spot, quite frankly, is kind of late 1990s to about 2007. So kind of that 10 to 15 or 10 to 18 year, depending on how you want to do the math, type investment where we can return a core plus to a core, you know, a B minus to an A minus, that type of thing. We're not playing at that AAA high-end luxury in these areas. We're kind of, it's in the, definitely the need-based in terms of what we're doing. And then lastly is leverage. We're 53% at year end here, loan to value. We're not financially engineering our returns. We certainly could have enhanced the IRRs if we'd have put more leverage on. We're not, we want to sleep well at night. And then we had 9 different lenders in our first fund, so we're not relying on any one lender. We're not just doing Fannie and Freddie GSE sponsored debt. Fund 2 is very similar in terms of how we structure that. And Fund 3, obviously, we've only made one investment in Southern California, so it's hard to have this conversation, but we would certainly hope to have this conversation in 3 years. Lastly, on page 51, which is our fees. We have a small, a medium, and a large fee. It's full disclosure, so you can see what it is. Depending on the investment, we have all three types of investors in our fund. We have an 8% preferred return, 75-25 thereafter, but we have no catch-up. I'm sure Rose can explain that to you, but I think that's very attractive. We're probably less than 10% of the funds have no catch-up, and I think that's very attractive for investor standpoint. And then certainly, I mentioned it earlier, but Mesro putting in $10 million, the team three, and the chairman and myself, the two largest investors. So again, strong alignment of interest. With that said, I answer any questions you may have.
100% multifamily, is that correct?
Correct.
But fund three is 100% is going to be multifamily?
Yes. Now, a couple of them may have some heavy student portion, but we're not going to Ann Arbor, Michigan, or Lincoln, Nebraska. Big Ten guys, so use that. But, you know, for example, we have a property in Midtown Atlanta in our first fund that's the closest to Georgia Tech, so by default, we're probably 75%, I'm guessing. But, you know, these are grad students, these are employees. You know, these are true market rate. It's not a student property in the sense that you might think heads on beds for room. So, yes, to that question.
You had also mentioned that legal immigrants are a big driver.
One of the drivers, yes.
Do you check for green card?
we have a very thorough credit check. So if you don't have established, you know, we do criminal background checks. Everybody does that. So everything, yes.
And your background is what, accounting?
I did accounting and finance at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So I'm a badger, I guess you could say.
Could you talk about the real estate market in general? You know, a lot of people say it's overheated, you know, not a great time to buy things, that kind of, you know, steer away from, you know, real estate, sort of talk about how you mitigate sort of those issues and how hot you think the real estate market is.
Sure. I think that the core markets, so kind of that state and Maine, it's been bid up a lot over the last 3-4 years. There's been a lot of money pouring in from institutions into the core market. I think that that's fairly pricey, fairly frothy. I think the institutions are now starting to switch into the value-add space. I think it's a terrific time to invest in the value-add space, although I can tell you it's more competitive today than it has been. And I have no doubt it will continue to be competitive. I would break out the real estate into really kind of five areas. One is retail. I think I just can say the word Amazon, and I say that whole retail is it's changing quickly. So I think that there's some higher risk than one might think in retail. Number two is office. I would tell you, if you look at the long-term vacancy rate in office, you look at subleasing, and you look at the performance in NCREIF, which is our target market, apartments have outperformed office by 263 basis points per year since 1990. They've outperformed every property sector. I would say there's probably only one sector that I like better than multifamily today, which would be industrial. And I think that industrial is just hard to get scale, quite frankly. You can go buy a large distribution center and it could be $20 million, and so it's harder to get your dollars out in that area, but I do like that area, quite frankly. And then I would tell you hotels, which would be the last area. You know, you've got day leases. I think it's been a lot of supply put in hotels. I think it's the riskiest of all asset classes. But when you look at NCREIF and you look at, you know, one of the questions I said, well, apartments, you know, is it niche? No, apartments is the second largest property sector. Mm-hmm. By the time we're all hopefully on a beach somewhere with a pina colada or some other cocktail, it'll be the largest property sector in the U.S. It's only second behind office. And I think if you slice and dice the NCREIF returns, if you'd have just done apartments, you'd have had the best investment thesis. And if you'd have just done west and south apartments, you'd have done even better. Now, if you had to take out apartments out of the equation and you just did commercial real estate and you just did west and south, you'd have done better as well. So there's a couple of aspects of that. I do think that, you know, look, there's throwing out these tax cuts, right? ever gets done. That could be a boom for the economy. I see rates continuing to rise. So I think you got to look at inflationary pressures as well. One of the things that we haven't really had time to talk about was construction costs. Construction costs continue to rise. I would tell you that I think construction costs in general have risen faster than rents. And so I think that you're going to continue to see hopefully a measured supply on each of the four property sectors in terms of what we're doing. But I would say that if we have inflation, which I see potentially coming, that's going to be good for commercial real estate in general. I think long-term office leases are probably the one exception on whether you may or may not catch that type thing. But I do think that when you look at the type of assets that, you know, and again, I don't want to bring it back to us because the question was general, but I think the kind of that luxury higher-end asset, I think certainly has a lot of capital premium associated with it because there's a lot of people trying to buy that stuff, or at least have been over the last 3-4 years.
All right. Any lemons in your portfolio?
We have one in Houston, our first fund. We're still higher than what it was, but it's certainly down in value the last couple of years. We have a second Houston investment in our second fund that I would tell you is slightly below our invested value. And then we've got two DC assets in fund one that will probably be high single digit returns at the end of the day. I don't anticipate us losing money on any investment, to be honest with you. But, you know, knock on wood, we haven't before, but, you know, we could see some low single digit returns on a couple of investments.
All right.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a nice week.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Enjoy the weather.
Last one? You can move. All
right.
Now it's 11. I have to leave. I have
another meeting. They're still going. You want to wait? We can. No. Cindy, stuff. Cindy, is something you want to? No. I don't have anything on this. Okay. No,
we can probably
get
it in.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Ooh. Mm-hmm. Snickers.
There's some pens are out there. I'll some pens are
out. I have a couple of Snickers and finish it off with a light
stick. Jeez. What an idea. Westport.
So why we can't have a plenty club here?
We're being double teamed here.
Thanks for having us this morning.
So you have 20 minutes for your formal presentation and about 10 minutes for questions.
Okay.
What's yours? Well, let's start with introductions. Jordan Sakharansky, portfolio manager for the fund that we're going to present you with today. Eric Kerr just joined the team in October of last year. One of the newer members, actually, of the Westport team. It's a team that's worked together for quite some time. So we're here today to present you with Special Core Plus Fund 2. Wanted to be sure to say thank you for your commitment to Fund 1. Jordan will talk a little bit about it, but we're on pace and on target to achieve everything that we had previously set out early in the investment period, so we're very pleased with that. And so we wanted to come back and present you with Fund 2, which is an extension and a continuation of Fund 1. Just kind of top level and logistically, we're not going to turn pages of the presentation. We'll refer to certain pages just to be careful with your time. But with that, maybe I'll give a little bit of an overview on Westport Capital, who we are and what we do. So Westport Capital is based in Wilton, Connecticut. We have offices in Los Angeles, Bozeman, Montana. You may have noticed that.
and in London, UK. We do invest globally, although primarily in the United States, and this fund will be a domestic fund. So, like I said, the team has been working together for quite some time, including all of the partners. I think that you've all worked together for 22 some odd years.
Correct. I actually am the youngest partner. I've been with the team 17 years. So, real continuity and longevity of the team, and that's kind of extends all the way down to the analysts.
Right. So, 35 professionals spread among the offices that I mentioned, and we primarily run two strategies, an opportunistic strategy and the special core plus strategy that we'll talk about in detail today. Maybe, Jordan, you want to go into our approach?
Sure. I think just to emphasize that today we managed about $2.5 billion of equity capital. That's after returning about $1 billion since inception. And really, since the credit crisis, we've worked our way down the capital structure, first in primary markets where we were buying debt, and then worked our way down to direct property investments. And in more recent years, we've been doing that in what we call secondary markets, which are really 18-hour type cities, cities to us that have good population growth, diversified economic drivers, strong growing corporate bases. And what we have found is the recovery across the country has been really uneven. Primary markets today, really gateway cities like a New York or a San Francisco or a Miami, are priced to perfection. And secondary markets still really have room to run. We could still buy assets at a discount to replacement cost, below prior peak levels, and really see a growing opportunity set. But today we're very cautious. We put a real premium on capital preservation. We're not really comfortable underwriting growth, even in these secondary markets. We're at almost full employment. GDP growth has been strong. We're not the group that's going to say, instead of having just 18 quarters of positive growth, it's going to run to 25 quarters. What we're trying to do is find situations in markets that have real value attributes where we could take an underperforming asset and bring it to current market levels. And if there is growth, that's a chance for appreciation on top of what we've underwritten. We do invest across sectors, across the capital structure. Every situation, we ask the same five questions. Who's the seller? Why are they selling? What did they do right? What did they do wrong? And what can we do better? If we can't answer those questions, it's not an opportunity for us. To explain some of our biases, we like to buy at high going-in yields. To us, basis is really important. Again, because we're not betting on growth, we want to kind of make our money on the buy. So we want to, again, make sure we're in at a discount to market, discount to replacement cost. In some of the markets that we're focused in, like Portland or Denver or Salt Lake, again, you could buy, let's say, office buildings between a 7 and 8% yield. If we had to buy an office building in New York today, it'd be at a 3% yield. Just to give you a little math, if a 3% yield were to back up to 5% because of rising interest rates, you could lose 40% of your value. But if you buy in at an 8% yield and it gaps out to 10, you kind of live to fight another day. And that's what we're focused on. But again, there is a broad opportunity set. And maybe to put in perspective what we've done in Fund 1, if you could turn to page 14, I'll touch on some other themes. One key theme is diversification. So we're in many different markets. We have in Fund 1 over 2 million square feet in the portfolio, covering over 160 tenants, all strong credits, diversified industries. We don't want to be overexposed to any given sector. And what we look for are situations where there's good recurring predictable in-place income. So a typical building for us would be maybe 60, 70, 80% occupied. The tenants that are there have been there for a while. We expect them to stay, but there's, let's say, rents below market and quality vacant space to lease. And that's how we could drive our investment yields over time. We have gravitated to markets that, again, we consider to be value alternatives. I touched on Portland or Denver or Salt Lake. What we like about those markets is rental rates don't justify a lot of new construction. We're very focused on supplying demand. We want barriers to entry. But again, we want places that have strong demand drivers. And those types of cities have really benefited from strong economic growth. A lot of, let's say, corporate migration out of more expensive markets, like, let's say, a lot of companies have been displaced from San Francisco actually into these type of markets. You have a growing tech corridor, but again, at more affordable levels. Another big theme that we focused on in the first fund was medical office. Why? Because it's, in our opinion, recession resilience. The real estate is mission critical to the tenants. They heavily invest in their space, and you have just tremendous demand drivers. We have focused initially in the Midwest, where you could again buy these type of facilities at, you know, high going in yields, and we think that the credit profile is very strong and the income streams are very predictable, and that's what we care about. We want good cash flow to underpin returns, and then we want to distribute that cash flow to you quarterly. Our focus has been to target about a 4-6% annual yield. We've met that in the first fund, and we only see that increasing as renovation projects have been completed and there's more free cash to distribute. In each of our investments, the first step is to address deferred maintenance, really reposition the building. Many of our investments have really languished under their prior ownership, and so we really have to breathe life into them and take a real entrepreneurial spirit to again, reintroduce that asset to the marketplace. And that's what we've done successfully in Fund 1, and we'll continue to do that in Fund 2. But it is also a time where there are other sectors that present compelling value. One key theme that we're going to explore in Fund 2 are industrial locations that are a play on the widening of the Panama Canal. And we have a pipeline of investment opportunities from Jacksonville to Savannah to Charleston. Both office and industrial, we see real growth as cargo gets rerouted more efficiently to the East Coast. So Fund 2 will have more industrial assets. Multifamily as a sector has seen a lot of supply, but most of that supply has been at Class A and very high rents. And what we see are opportunities to take more Class B type product where we could improve the units and then, let's say, raise rents and get a return on those investment dollars. But again, in markets that have just not been inundated with supply. We are a little shy on retail. I don't know today what is considered, let's say, e-commerce resistant, but retail that is necessity-driven, ancillary to residential or office, or really experiential is retail that we would focus on. And what I would say is, while we're staying away from primary markets at the present time, what may bring us back to those markets first is hospitality. Of all the sectors we cover, hospitality has corrected first. RevPAR has started to decline as a result, cap rates have backed up. New York, as an example, has had 2 years of negative growth and declining profit margins because expenses have gone up at the same time as revenues have contracted. We now see values resetting, and we actually are looking at several hotel opportunities in New York. So there is a broad opportunity set out there, but you have to really pick your spots. And again, today is a very important time to be an active manager, not one that's just making market bets. And you have to put the premium on capital preservation because we are in a late cycle environment. We don't expect widespread distress. We don't see signs of it. There are certain situations to take advantage of, but what we like to say is 79% of the country lives in the suburbs, and the suburbs have not fully recovered yet, and there's room to run. And again, that's our focus.
Can you talk about leverage in terms of our approach?
Yes, so we've always been a firm that runs low leverage. We don't like to rely on debt to drive returns. What we use debt is really to have an efficient capital structure, to drive return of capital, and we only put debt in areas where there's cash flow to service the debt. So if we ever buy a building that has a significant amount of vacancy, we won't put debt on that vacancy. That just adds financial risk, and we're not looking to take on financial risk. Really, all we're underwriting today is how to take an underperforming asset that's been starved of capital, neglected by its current ownership, to current market levels. And if there's growth on top of that, that's the plus. From a return perspective, we're targeting 9 to 11% net returns and again, about 4 to 6% annual distribution yields, and we will use about 50% loan-to-cost leverage. On a loan-to-value basis, that would even be more conservative. And depending on the individual asset, if there's an asset that has significant cash flow, it'll take on more debt, but at the fund level, we'll average around 50%. Anything else you think we should cover?
Maybe just the pipeline a little bit, the size of the pipeline.
Yeah, so what we've always focused on is being a true middle market investor. We like equity checks that range from, let's say, $10 million to $60 million. And if it's on the higher end of the range, it's in a portfolio of assets. We've always invested with that style. We've always been in these more secondary type markets. We are very hands-on. Everything we buy, we have a cradle-to-grave approach. So if you are the analyst that made the acquisition, you're responsible for that investment from inception all the way through business plan implementation and disposition. So you have full accountability of the team on each of the investments. We have great sourcing channels in each of these markets because we've always been active managers in these markets. Most of our opportunities really come from either investment banks, special servicers, government agencies, or private sellers. We don't necessarily participate in auctions. Our belief is if you're in an auction, you're either paying the highest price to suffer the lowest return, or you knew something special that allows you to participate in that auction. We like off-market deals, and again, we like to ask our five questions on each opportunity. And if we can't answer them, then we're on to the next opportunity. But maybe I'll give you a couple of specific examples of what we did in Fund 1, just to give you a sense of what's exciting to us. If you look at page 14, Oak Creek, Bellevue, Mohawk, and Panzerborn all have a similar profile. These were assets held by institutional owners that had owned them for a long period of time. They stopped putting money into them. They weren't aggressively leasing vacant space. Rents had fallen below market. Rents in each of those buildings were 20 to 30% below market. We were buying in between a 7 and 9% going in yield. With 50% debt, we were getting between, or we are getting between a 12 and 16% current return. There's real credit tenants in place on long-term leases, and again, that's a real underpinning of value. All of the assets were bought at a discount to replacement cost and below prior peak levels. Oak Creek actually was owned by a mortgage REIT called iStar Financial. It's all flex industrial assets, nine properties, and they had a stated mandate to get out of their net lease business, and they had neglected it for the last 4 or 5 years. Denver was actually bought out of a private fund that was in liquidation. Portland, the two Portland deals were bought from a very large open-ended core fund that had owned those assets for over 20 years. And it frankly made their returns many years ago, and these were just kind of non-core to them, but core to us. 140 and 150 Grand is worth spending a couple minutes on because this is a really interesting situation. There are two office buildings immediately adjacent to the Court District in White Plains, New York. Every tenant in those buildings is there because they want to be near the courts. That's another thing that we look for, real predictable, sticky cash flow and tenancy. Unless they move the courts, these buildings will always be fully occupied. We were able to buy these at a 9% going in yields. Around $140 a foot. Replacement cost in that market's over $300. Since we bought those buildings, we've extended all the leases, we've increased rents, we've addressed all the deferred maintenance, we had the property taxes reassessed downwards, we cut utility expenses. That's a key theme in all of our buildings. We try and be very energy efficient. So we, at the onset, we'll make capital investments to bring down energy costs. We think that anytime we could create a more affordable occupancy cost for a tenant, it means they could pay us more in rent. Mm-hmm. So we're very cost focused.
So what do you do to entice the higher rent? I mean, you have to modify the buildings. I mean, what are you doing to?
Correct. So maybe a great example is Goodwin Square. Goodwin Square was a building in Hartford, Connecticut that was only about 45% occupied at the time of purchase. This building cost originally $250 million to build. We bought it for $20 million. Hartford's been in decline for 20 years. However, what's happened in Hartford is there used to be 10 Class A buildings and now there's five. And of the five that are remaining, three are 100% occupied and two had significant vacancy, this being one of them. I'm going to answer your question, but I want to just set the stage just for a second. What's unique about this situation is there was a dormant hotel. We allocated about $2 million of our cost basis to it. We sold it immediately for $5 million. So we took our $20 million basis down to $15 million. That's like $40 a foot. We can't find a comp in Hartford that sells for less than $200. When we're fully leased, we will be in for the low $100 a foot range. We did a major renovation to this building. The lobbies, the corridors, all the mechanical systems, it's been completely re-imaged. It really had no leasing visibility. So to answer your question, we want to see every deal and we want to be aggressive. There's no reason why we can't, at our cost basis, lose a leasing opportunity in Hartford in this building. We give very aggressive tenant improvement allowances. We pay aggressive leasing commissions. The brokerage community is focused on us. We have their attention. And we really deliver value to the tenant, and that's how we drive rent. We're very responsive as a landlord. The space is in perfect condition. I constantly canvass our tenants to see what we could do to increase tenant satisfaction. That gets disseminated throughout the brokerage community. Once you're known as a responsive, well-capitalized landlord, you're going to see the leasing activity, and then if you're aggressive, your capital, you're going to drive rents. And I like the question because that's really the way we create value. We could buy in at, a 7 or 8% yield, drive rents to north of a 10% yield, and then we could exit at an 8% yield. We don't have to bet on cap rates falling because they're not going to fall any further. We're not the group that's going to say buy something at a 4 cap because it's going to trade at a 2. We're not willing to do that. Also, we look for situations where rents are below market. So if we create the product, we could capture that discount in rents. And that's what we've done time and time again, and Fund 1 is an example of doing that successfully.
And in the case of Goodwin Square, it's gone from 45%.
Yes, to 70% in under a year. That's another good point, Aaron, because we budgeted about 4 years to lease the building. We're very conservative in our timelines, and we're today 2.5 years ahead of pace in lease-up. We signed Bank United as an anchor tenant. Their name will be on the building, and complete the story on this one. It was bought all cash because there wasn't enough in-place income to service debt. But now that it's well leased, Bank United is actually writing a mortgage against the building. We will retire about $10 million of our basis in that financing, and that's the return of capital to our investors, or it will be reinvested in the fund. But that's our approach. It was bought all cash. We did a major repositioning. We've been very successful on the lease-up. We performed well against very conservative assumptions, and now we're starting to see the value creation and the return of capital.
So, how long before you totally cash out your first fund?
We're targeting about a 4 to 6 year average life. You will start to see monetizations as early as late fourth quarter this year. Once buildings are fully stabilized, we then have to decide, do we hold it for income or do we monetize it to capture appreciation? And I'll tell you that what drives that decisioning is the rent rolls. If we have, good example is if we sign a 10-year lease, it's great to hold the asset for 2 or 3 years and then still sell the asset with 7 years or a new lease term.
Yeah.
What we don't want to do is sign a 5-year lease, hold the asset for 4 years, and then sell it with uncertainty. So the rent rolls will drive some of the decisioning upon exit, but also when we created our value, it's time to move on. It's time to package it for sale and let the next person take on some risk. So there will be asset recycling within the fund. We've always done that well. Frankly, each of our funds we've invested over one time, and we're going to start doing that with Fund 1 as well.
Can you talk about sort of the diversity of your fund by property type? It's very diverse. A lot of other funds are very predominantly multi-family. And sort of why are you positioned the way you are versus having a large portion of your fund more in a multifamily?
It's a great question. It's almost a softball for me, and I appreciate it.
You teed it up pretty good.
Let's start with the definition. Special Corps Plus. Special means we could go anywhere, and we do go anywhere for opportunity. We think we have to reinvent ourselves every day of the week. That's in our DNA. That's our entrepreneurial spirit. Multifamily is a nice asset class, but it's not always a great time to be a multifamily investor. And if you look at where we are today, we are very concerned about all of that supply pressure and the fact that rents have grown to levels that we think stress affordability. Not every market, and I'm sure that there are many managers that will still find compelling multifamily opportunities, but as a sector, it's overdue, in our opinion. We want to be diversified because when you're in a late cycle environment and you're not just in a rising tide, you have to be really careful to pick your spots. So that we're being very judicious with how we deploy capital. So I've explained the special, any sector, any market, anywhere in the capital structure, trying to find value opportunities in a late cycle environment. The core part is each of the buildings really has in place stable, predictable, recurring cash flow. And the plus is hopefully, and our expectation is, we will capture growth that's not underwritten, that's kind of off the page. Goodwin being an example. In 2 years ahead of our underwriting is our way of creating value as opposed to the market just continuing to grow. But the diversification is something we've always done. Each of our funds have always had about 20 to 30 individual investments, again, that range in size from 10 million up to 80. We don't want any particular investment to make or break the fund. We want lower volatility. Again, that's also a way to put a premium on capital preservation and to really protect the downside.
And when you're looking at Fund 1 here, it looks like right now it has a lot of office, industrial, healthcare. Will it have other investments to sort of round that out? Or?
Yes, okay. Yes. And again, it's trying to find the best opportunities at any point in time. When we started Fund 1, I could have shown you on a chart that the cheapest asset class globally was U.S. suburban office. And you look at the value disparities between suburban office in the U.S. and, let's say, major market office or any other international market, we didn't see a better risk-return profile elsewhere. Medical office came from our healthcare strategy. We've always been active healthcare investors. What we wanted was lower volatility, income streams that weren't as, let's say, sensitive to changes in healthcare or reimbursement rates. If you look at a medical tenant, less than 5% of revenue is their occupancy cost. So if their revenues fluctuate, they're not gonna take it out on their landlord. Very healthy rent coverage. That's what we thought was a great way to start Fund 1. Now that we're seeing hotel values correct, some retail situations that, again, in our opinion, are e-commerce resilient, and some multifamily, but in markets that, again, aren't overheated. I'll give you one specific deal we just passed on, which just shows some of our fear. Austin, Texas, is a great city. Yeah, it's a growing city. One could argue it doesn't have enough barriers to entry. But we did find an excellent multifamily project, and we had a great business plan, and you could have bought it right. And our concern was you could have done everything right, and if cap rates just gapped out 50 or 100 basis points, all that value that we created would have been eroded. We don't want situations where the story could be written outside of our control. We want areas that you're a little more insulated from financial risk, whether it's rising interest rates or cap rates. That means you've got to be really careful to pick your spots. We passed on more deals than we do. That's another thing I want to emphasize. We probably look at between 15 and 25, you know, credible opportunities a week. We're a very efficient funnel. We meet as a team every Monday and Thursday to review our pipeline. We challenge each other. We never ask how much money we can make. We ask how do we protect the downside. Once we know the downside is protected, then we rely on our asset management expertise to create the value.
So Fund 1 is 80% committed, which is why we're going back out to raise Fund 2 to continue in the same investment teams, given the pipeline.
Correct. And one thing I would say that hasn't been a challenge for us, but a notable difference between Fund 1 and Fund 2 is Fund 1, being a $230 million fund, the largest check we wrote was $20 million. And we've been, and again, that was more in a portfolio of assets. Actually, Oak Creek was a little larger. I think they had 30 million invested. It was like 9 properties. Fund 2, we're going to raise somewhere between 500 and 750 million. The deal sizes will still be the same, but we'll be able to take advantage of more portfolio opportunities. It's the same skill set and the same sourcing channel to source a 2-property portfolio versus 4 or 5. Again, individual asset sizes are the same, the risk profile is the same, but there is a scalable opportunity set, and we've been, let's say, a little constrained from taking advantage of that in Fund 1. One example I'll give you is in the state of Florida, we've seen some great healthcare sale-leaseback opportunities. We're actually negotiating an agreement now with a healthcare provider in Central Florida that has 5 medical office buildings and 2 rehab surgery centers, and it's about a $60 million portfolio. It will need about $30 million of equity, and what we like about it is the healthcare group will sign a master lease. All of the properties will be crossed, so they can't cherry pick or give up any. It'll be a 15-year new lease. It has excellent rent coverage out of the box. We're buying the real estate at close to a 7.5% going in yield, with 50% debt, it'll be at 13% current return. That's something we wouldn't have the capacity to do in Fund 1, but we will have the capacity to do in Fund 2.
So with all those
positives,
why aren't they selling?
Because, oh, great question. So healthcare is going through. Healthcare is going through consolidation and growth. They want to free up capital from the real estate to acquire additional practices. And they realize they're in the healthcare business, not the real estate business, and we could be a great real estate partner to them and help accelerate and accommodate their growth. In fact, as they identify additional acquisition targets, we could be a source of financing by acquiring the real estate and leasing to them. And we have active discussions with healthcare practices across the country in similar type situations. You're seeing a lot of consolidation, and size is helpful to these healthcare providers.
Perhaps I missed it earlier. The target fund is between 500 million and 9 billion.
Correct.
That's quite a range. Where do you anticipate you're going to wind up?
Erin, you want to handle that?
So, a billion would be the cap. We think it'll probably be between 500 and 750 million, and we're still a little early, frankly, to kind of guess where we're going to end up. Our first close that we're targeting is in the fourth quarter, but we're still a little early. I would say between 500 and 750.
This may help put it in perspective. As a team, over the last 2 years, we've deployed upwards of 500 million capital across several strategies. Special Corp Plus 2 will be our dedicated focus for the foreseeable future. This is the best opportunity we see for our investors. This is the most scalable strategy we have. We want to take advantage of the opportunities. We don't want to pass on them. And we want a little more gas in the tank than we had in Fund 1. So that is really the thought process. In addition, it being our investment focus, we've really freed up a lot of asset management capacity because a lot of our prior funds are in liquidation. You know, we've returned upwards of $1 billion of capital. That's freed up resources to focus on this initiative.
And perhaps I was not listening in the beginning, or it's my failing hearing, which will happen to all of you all as you advance in age. Your background educationally and also from a professional standpoint.
Sure. I'm sorry, we didn't provide that. So let me say that I'm, where did I start? Okay, I'm Canadian by background. I grew up in Montreal, Canada. I went to school at the University of Western Ontario. I graduated from the Richard Ivey School of Business. From there, I moved down to New York, and I worked for Solomon Smith Barney doing real estate investment banking. I guess Solomon was then gobbled up by Citigroup. I finished at a bank when it was called Citigroup. From there, I joined with my current team when they were at their predecessor firm called Oaktree Capital. And I was at Oaktree Capital from, I guess, 2001 through late 2005. And then we formed Westport in early 2006, and I've been there ever since. I'm a portfolio manager at Westport, but I also consider myself a generalist. I work across our strategies. We all are generalists. That's what makes us stronger on the acquisition front. You can't buy a building unless you've managed one. And if you haven't managed one successfully, you have no business buying the next building. And that's really our discipline and thought process. And again, I'm one of I'm the youngest partner, but I've been with the team, I guess, almost 16 years between Oaktree and Westport. Most of the team has worked together even before Oaktree started, going back to their days at Trust Company of the West. And you get a lot of veteran experience, if you will. We've been through many different recessionary environments, the credit crisis, and we, you know, always live to fight another day. And that's a credit to being a low-leveraged investor, a risk-averse investor, putting a real premium on capital preservation, and again, not being focused on hitting home runs, but singles and doubles, you know, taking care of the rest.
I'm from Northeastern Pennsylvania, and then studied in the University of Rochester, studied economics, made my way to New York, where I was in real estate banking, went through workouts in the financial crisis on the banking side, earned my stripes, and left the kind of banking side of the world and went to the equity side of the world, worked with Dish Inspire before joining Westport Capital last October.
Who will be our contact person?
Both of us.
It's a small team. You're welcome to contact any of us.
Yeah, we want to be accessible. Again, you're our partners. Partners, you know, have questions, they would be answered. We're very responsive. We can put out, you know, good quarterly letters explaining all of our activities, good and bad. We're very transparent as an organization.
We do call people back in to kind of check on the results, particularly if they don't look like they're terrific. So you all are prepared for that, but hopefully it won't come to us.
And it'd be our pleasure to come present.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great afternoon.
You're on your way.
Cindy, you have anything for your bail?
No.
Bye-bye.
Just here for the listening pleasure.
We're 11% real estate now, right?
Yeah, a good chart to look at is page 23. And so your target is 12.5 and you're at 11.3. And if you look at the Colony money and the Town Square money, that's coming back to you. So, you know, you invested there and that money is going to be distributed back to you, sort of as they call money. So that's why it's about $4 million maybe, mm-hmm. you know, yep. to permit, because as that money comes back, that needs to be redeployed.
Oh, you, if you want to keep on going.
Okay. Would you like to talk about the real estate, folks, or you want to go through the presentation first, the president, the board, whatever?
Well, let's talk about real estate while they're...
Yeah, while it's fresh.
Okay. Did you like one? Do you like one more than the others? Or? If you look at our book, sort of this, we'll go through a summary. Just, page 7 of our book. So Ares, the first firm, is based out of LA. They're a very large firm. They don't just do real estate. They do a whole bunch of things. So they have a very large business. I think he said in his presentation 10% of what they do is real estate.
Right.
If I'm remembering right. So a very large firm, but been doing real estate for a long time. Mesoros, based out of Chicago. Again, they do real estate, but they also do private equity and some other things. And then you've got Westport, more of a a niche firm, and they already manage money for you, and all they do is real estate. They don't do anything else. They don't manage any other kind of assets. They're based out of Connecticut. If you flip to the next page, page 8, ownership structure, all of them have employee ownership within their structure. Ares does have some publicly traded parts of their company, and the ownership, some of that is through public, being publicly owned. The owners own it through stock, publicly traded stock. Assets under management, so you've got Ares, basically the biggest, almost at 100 billion. Mesro on page 8, 31 billion, and then Westport at 2 billion. Again, Westport only doing real estate. Years investing, sort of there. Everybody has a long history of doing this. Westport actually has been in the real estate investing business. These folks who came from Oak Tree, probably the longest of the people in real estate. Page 9 shows their funds and what their funds have done historically, so different funds that they've had. Page 10 just gives you leverage amounts and fund details. Again, the first fund, Ares, is about 50 to 60% apartments, and then the other sectors, you can see that there in the middle. Mesero is 100% apartments, which they talked about, and then Westport has the diversification more during property sectors, which is why I asked that question. Leverage, you can see the leverage there. All of them have pretty low leverage. Westport, in general, is the most sort of downside protected of the three that you presented. They're very conservative in what they're not bullish on anything. Bernie and them may get along very well. They are not bullish on the economy, and they don't think everything's going to, you know, going to keep going up forever.
Right.
And that's how they invest. And I think that was something that you really liked about them last time that they presented. If you look at the top, both Ares and Mesro have already raised some money. They're a little bit further along than Westport. Westport just really started marketing, so they're just really starting in, you know, in the business of getting out there and telling people about this fund. Page 11 just gives you the investment time frame. Both Ares and Mesro, 3 years investment period. Westport's 2 years. Westport, in general, is a little bit of a shorter time frame than other funds. They like to invest their money, get it invested, get the money back, return it, and they typically, you know, in 7 or 8 years are going to be in and out of a fund, is what they like to do. But around 10 years for these funds. Minimum investments, they'll take whatever you want to give them, so, you know, they have to say those things there. And then some, restrictions. We don't want them doing development. That's not what you're looking at, you know. So there are restrictions there in their funds. Page 12, management fees, which we talked about, so compares them across the board. The management fees aren't huge, you know, hugely different between the three of them. I would say Ares looks a little bit more expensive than the other ones because they had the general partner catch up with the 60-40 sort of split, which I guess is more of a European way to do it. Typically, I don't see that as much. But they all have the same preferred return, so you get your 8%. They don't get any extra money until they give you your 8%. Then after that, they've got a 20%. Ares gets 20%. Mesro gets 25 and Westport gets 20, which is so Mesro a little bit more expensive there. But they guess they offset that by they don't have the catch-up provision.
Right.
So that's basically it. We like all three. They're recommended firms. We give a little bit of a summary there on page 13. And that's about it. You got to hear them present all their details.
And I apologize for meeting to the next.
Okay.
Had the meeting before and not really being in focus. All right, we've got about 15.5 million in that sector or part of our overall portfolio. Mm-hmm. where is our money coming from now that we're going to be putting into, we're getting out of something, or is it just...
No, they call the money over time as they find the properties to buy.
Yeah.
So say you commit $4 million to them, they're going to call it over 3 years, just a little bit at a time.
My question really was, where are we getting the money to put into this investment now?
As these, like Colony, if you see there under real estate and Town Square, they're going to be distributing money to you. So they're going to be giving you your investment back because those funds are ending.
All right. What was Colony's strong suit, and what was Town Square's strong suit as far as what kind of real estate did they invest in?
There are diversified funds also.
I'm sorry?
Diversified funds by property type, so they're diversified also.
All right,
also.
So one of like they weren't strong multifamily or whatever. Do we have anything here that was strong multifamily of the existing funds that we have?
Well, Long Wharf has a lot of multifamily in their portfolio, the two Long Wharf funds.
Yeah, but Long Wharf hasn't been giving us good returns either.
So.
Yeah. But that was legacy stuff too, wasn't it? From what I can remember from past conversations, their issues were what?
Well, the first fund that you had with them, you know, struggled a little bit, but they stopped investing during the crisis, and then they picked back up. And so their fund has done well. The more recent stuff, what happens when you calculate returns is the more recent valuations, there's only one property left, and it can mess up how you look at the more recent returns. But over the long run, those are good returns. Fund 5 is still really early, so it's just an earlier fund. They haven't called all their money. They're going to call some money there, too. Bernie, to answer your question, we will take some money here from real estate that we already have invested to invest in this
from
new allocation.
From the distributions.
But also if we're over allocated in a place like equities and things like that, we can take the money from there too. As you see, we're over allocated in large cap and small cap by about 1%. So
we've got a range of going up to 15 in this sector, and we're only at 111.3 now. The current Westport fund that we have, what are their investments? Are they also kind of like this fund too in terms of opportunities?
Yeah, they have that sort of in their book, which they have 8 investments in there right now, and they're mostly office.
I guess what I'm looking at is, do we want to diversify within the real estate sector? In other words, if we don't have any multifamily, let's go with Mesro, or do we, you know, want to maybe build some additional conservatism into this thing and maybe like go with a Westport, who we've had decent results with? And how much do you anticipate? Where will we be when we get through with making this investment in terms of number of total dollars in real estate?
Yeah, I'm thinking of you committing around $4 million to this investment.
Okay.
And you might get up to the 13 or 14%
okay.
range, but then you end up distributing back to you. So, but you've done well. If you look at page... 30, you've done well to pick different years to invest in real estate, and that's what I always try to get you to do is to have different years. So if you look at the inception date, you got Colony at 2013, Town Square at 14, Westport at 15, Long Wharf at 16, so then you'll have an investment in 17, so that just really keeps you going with these real estate investments.
So do you tell Westport or Mesro, we're committing $4 million and send them money, or do you do it over a period of time?
No, you just say we're committing $4 million and they're not going to probably call a dollar until probably 2018.
Well, the first step is hopefully, legally, we can get a contract together.
Yeah, and we didn't ask that either in terms of these.
I pre-checked them all with Lee, and I sent Lee's partner, Scott, all the information. We asked our questions that Lee likes us to ask. they gave us answers. I didn't always like the way the answers were worded because I'm not a lawyer, but I was like, I don't know if they're answering it straight enough. And I sent them to Scott, and Scott said they looked fine for him. So I pre-qualified. There was actually two other people I was considering, and I threw them out because legally they didn't work. So legally you shouldn't have any problems. But if you do vote, I'd always vote a backup just in case. But because Scott, of course, said, well, we reserve the right to...
Right. A normal attorney
answer, right?
Bargain, right. Open to they look good, no but what they say.
It depends. That's a bit of a thing.
Right.
So I like Westport's diversification geographically and sectors.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. They said conservative, don't risk money, and they weren't. I was Mesereau was just apartments.
And then I would ask an additional question. Are we looking to just put $4 million with somebody or somebody?
Yeah, I'd like you to just pick one. I think it's good to just pick one.
Okay.
One of the three.
You heard my opinion.
Yeah, I'm kind of leaning towards Westport, but I enjoyed Mesereau. And
the guy was a smart guy. Yeah, right. That guy was pretty awesome.
And I've obviously been with him a couple of years, and I like Joe Hill, you know, in terms of what he was saying about Aries, because he talked up the, you know, the cash flow and not looking to make it at the end, which seems with Westport to be the thrust of it. If they make anything at the end, that's cream, you know, it's making it. But Mesereau's thrust is multifamily, and I mean, they may be absolutely right in terms of if they buy it right, and, you know, because there's a lot of stuff out there that old landlords haven't taken care of.
But he seemed to have facts and numbers really down to the...
He knows his stuff.
Yeah.
For
sure.
Yes.
I mean, so Westport, I mean, it's a faster turnaround. It's not a long-term... we're really not looking for high numbers anymore. We're looking more for security. I mean, so that's the whole thing is we keep on cutting back what we're looking to put out on the edge. We're just looking to make some returns to keep, you know, the old pension plan chugging along for another 20 years, I think. But we're slowly, you know, cutting back.
Are you looking then towards getting out of this thing in the short term, which would be a Westport as maybe a plus?
No, I'm just thinking that they're shortening the window on where you're going to see, you know, the numbers.
The numbers, yeah.
Because, you know, when we looked at the other, they're longer terms. I mean, you know, Aries was like...
8 years?
No, I think they were greater when I started looking at the charts. They were closer to like 15-year, you know, total return and closing out their individual, you know, commitments. And that's why I asked how long till you close it out. And it's not that we're looking for short-term, but also I think, you know, short-term shows that they're trying to, you know, hit their number and move on versus just sitting and riding it out. And I mean, you know, it's to me, I think that's important, too, that we look at, you know...
And then... Obviously, over the longer term, it can...
Well, it can,
yeah,
right.
Yeah,
and if we look in the shorter term, I mean, we hit it or we don't, and then move on and restructure if necessary. I mean, so I would agree with the two of you. My thoughts are, you know, Westport and then Minlo for the second. But Anthony?
Yeah, I think Westport really is... Their strategy is right on point with what we're trying to do with this pension. So.
Will the chair entertain a motion?
Sure.
I move that we go with Westport as our...
I'll second it.
And we have to have a second choice if something fell through. With something. I mean, I don't see it will because, you know, we're only using it. So.
Mesereau.
All right.
For me.
Second
for me.
All right.
All the time.
All those for those.
All right. Mesereau is two. So I should by motion, or is that a second motion to do Mesereau?
Yeah, and I second it all anyway.
Oh, okay.
So good. We voted for it for three.
Rose, good job at getting them together, getting them here. And vetting them.
Okay.
Yeah, vetting.
My research group, they do a good job.
Yes.
So. I still have sending people I don't like, I should send them back.
So do you see the same people?
I see a lot
next
of them.
Week. You'll see them next
sometimes.
Week.
Sometimes, yeah, it depends who's doing real estate. They were in Cape Coral, a couple months ago.
And there was nothing here in this thing from Westboro as to who the people were, so obviously they don't brag on themselves at all,
If I do dig an old one out, it's probably there. I mean, when they first introduced themselves, I'll introduce the team, but...
I guess they figure we know them, so that's right. Not as relevant.
So, Rose, what else do you have?
So, I'm going to go over your performance for your fund, which is what we always like to do. So, on page one, under tab one, it's just the markets. I usually talk more about these, but given we've had a lot of people talking today, I'm not going to go through. But I do like to draw your attention to page one, is what have the markets done over the quarter and the one-year period. And as you can see, world equities were up 4%, U.S. equities up 3%, international, so, coming back some, up 6%, emerging markets, which you have, up 6%, so good thing, for you to be in that asset class. I know maybe we got in a little bit early, but doing well now, good that you're there. Fixed income been very muted, as we know, given that interest rates, Fed's been raising interest rates. Commodities really the only negative sector there. You don't have a dedicated commodities allocation, and you probably won't see commodities do better until you see actual inflation in the market. We haven't seen that, but if we do get some inflation, you'll see commodities there. Real estate been doing well, private equity and hedge funds finally actually performing better, which we're happy about for your portfolio. Moving on to just your fund. And we'd like to look at page 23. You can see the whole snapshot together. So you're at $136,879,199. So maybe a high watermark for you, putting in a lot of money in this plan in addition to having good returns. Your target to large caps, 14%, you're at 15.2. Small cap targets at 6, you're at 7. Internationally, your target's at 22 and you're at 22.8. So right on your target there, a little bit over in equity. And that's just because equities had some really good returns here over the last year. And so that's sort of drawn that up a little bit. Fixed income, target of 32% and under that slightly at 29.7%. Now, I'll remind you that there's a lot of pension funds in the country. Most of them do not have 32% of fixed income. You are more conservative than them because you are a closed plan, might sound like a broken record to say that. I've said it a couple quarters, but just so you know, because you are a closed plan, your allocation is different than other plans who are trying to achieve a 7.5-8% return. You're going to have a more conservative allocation than them. Your real estate targets at 12.5, which we talked about, you're at 11.3, which is the reason we did that here today, to get somebody else on board. Your alternatives target is at 13.5, and you're at about 12, so a little bit under there. And that was more because you had PIMCO, you got rid of them, they weren't doing as well, you've hired Wellington to fit that spot, they've been doing very, very well. Page 24, your performance for the quarter. So for the quarter, you were up almost 3% at 2.84, a little bit under your policy, but strong there. Year to date, you outperformed your policy, 7.26 versus 7. 1 year return, close to 12% versus your policy at 10. So very strong 1 year returns here. You could see 3 year, 5 year, 10 year. Since inception returns, very strong. This plant in general has had, with all the issues that you've ever had with the city or all the it was never an investment problem. Your investments always have done very well here. You've always had, even though you've had rotations on the board, you've always been very diligent, and it's not true for all plans in Florida, but you've always been very diligent to watch the investments here, watch the fees on this plan, and to switch out managers when they're not performing. And that has served you well and has had strong performance on the plan. These are pages 25, 26 are your fiscal returns. Obviously, hopefully, knock on wood, we keep up performance through September, and hopefully you have another strong fiscal year. You had a good fiscal year last year. Page 28, just go through the managers. Wedge Capital doing well. This page 28, Wedge outperforming for the quarter, the year, the 1 year, the 3 year, the 5 year, the 7 year, the 10 year since inception. It's been a very good large cap growth value manager for you, doing very well. Wellington, we brought them in. You know, we had some concerns with them. Still a little bit muted returns here, still underperforming. But I think we had talked, we're going to wait a while, wait a couple quarters, watch them, and sort of see how their performance goes. I think it's too early to pull the plug on them. We talked about indexing here, but I think that we'll continue to sort of watch them there. Siebel Bryant Hamill, somebody you brought in recently too because you're worried about performance, but if you look at the quarter and the year-to-date, very strong numbers, come back strong, outperforming the benchmark by 2% for the year-to-date period. No concerns there. Templeton, underperformed for the quarter and the year-to-date a little bit there. If you remember, Templeton has a little bit of emerging markets in there. That's why you have two benchmarks. One benchmark has emerging markets, one benchmark doesn't. So it's a little bit more difficult to see how they're performing because if you have as much emerging markets as the ACWI, which is the second benchmark, you're going to do different than as if you do the EV. But you can see their one-year return really strong, outperforming by 2%. So happy to see that there. No concerns. If you look since inception, they outperform year over year since inception, since 2000, which is 17 years, to outperform your benchmark by 2%. I mean, that's a strong manager. You're going to have a little bit quarters here and there that may not do as well, but over the long run is what you're looking for. Acadian, underperform a little bit for the quarter, but if you look at that one-year number and since inception, you can't really beat that. Really good returns there. And really positive to have those emerging markets. Like I said, you got an asset class here that was 10% of your portfolio that was up 20% year-to-date. I mean, that's very, very additive. Pyramus doing well, outperforming the benchmark. Not great returns for fixed income, but you need that sort of stable part in your portfolio. Double Line, similar thing. Underperforming a little bit for the quarter, but you look at the 1 year and since inception doing well. UBS managed core real estate. They talked to you a lot about core real estate here today. It's just an asset class that, you know, has been overheated. It's a hard asset class. UBS is one of the biggest ones in the industry. We're going to continue to watch them here. It might be a point where we want to look at maybe some other core real estate managers because consistently under, and they've been under, you know, they're outperforming since inception, but that's about it. They've sort of eroded that. So it's something we want to look at. We may look at some names next meeting. They have sort of a stable part of your real estate portfolio, so they have a lot of money. They have $8 million, 6% of your portfolio. You know, having a 9% return on the 3 and 5 years is not bad, but if we could have had an 11% return, that would have been better. So we really need to probably...
More is better.
Yeah, we need to probably bring them in and talk to them about that portfolio and then see if there's maybe some options there. Wellington, great move. Good out of PIMCO, hired them. They've done fabulous for you. 14% return since inception. Atos, actually seeing some nice returns. Like, you know, look here, almost 2% for the quarter. Year to date, 1 year number strong. What I would like to do, Atos is a hedge fund for you. They manage, you know, assets, but they have higher fees than a lot of your other managers. We were sort of waiting for them to come back. At some point, you may want not to have hedge funds in your portfolio at all. I would suggest taking about $2 million out of this portfolio and moving it to Wellington. It's in the same asset class, but it's a lot cheaper in fees. And now that we've seen a little bit bounce back from that, I think to trim them back is a good time to do that. So I would make that recommendation there if you want to take that recommendation. You know, because this is a closed plan, you're more and more conscious of fees. And if you can get a manager like a Wellington to do a similar thing as an Atos, and you can do it for half the fee.
Well, and Wellington has consistently outperformed their expectations.
So I think that would be a good little bit of a repositioning and just a trimming back of Atos a little bit. They do have 6% of your portfolio, and maybe moving that. And it takes a while. It takes you like 6 months to get that money. So you request it now, and you're not getting it for 4 or 5 months. So that's also an issue. You know, you want to be able to trim at the right time. And then page 30, your real estate investments, all doing well. Long Wharf 5, it's too early. You know, that's a 16 fund, so it's too early. But you look at that since inception IRRs, you can see all of them doing well. This 2008 fund for Long Wharf, these more recent returns don't mean much. You don't have very little. You have like 55,000. So this will come off. Next quarter, that'll come off your performance chart because those don't really mean anything. You know, it's like, you know, it's worth 55,000. Well, now it's worth 53 or 50, you know, and so it's not as meaningful. But good solid returns, nothing there. So other than my recommendation that I think that you should, you know, trim back Atos a little bit and give that money to Wellington, I think a $2 million trim would be nice. Other than that, I don't have any recommendations except for bringing UBS into the next meeting so we can just talk to them.
So do we have going in about it?
That's right.
Yeah. I make a motion.
I'll second. Yep.
All those four. Jessica, got that?
I got it.
All right. Do you know if there's anything that the attorney would report? We even need to call in? Scott didn't say anything?
No, from what I hear, between the emails, he said if we need him, we can call in.
Right.
What is ailing Lee? What is ailing Lee?
He's got heart issues.
It is existing that have just kind of...
I think they've worsened, yeah. My biggest issue is that we don't really have a succession plan for him.
And Scott can't handle it. But does Scott handle the fire or the police? What does he handle?
Scott doesn't handle anything else for the city.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
I'm sorry?
Lee does for police.
For police, yeah.
Okay, so Scott's not acting at all?
No,
So that was a misunderstanding on my part. Chris, I went to a couple of their dog and pony shows that they did down in Barry's, and Scott would be the presenter. So I thought he was the contact guy with the police plant, but that's not the case.
That's not the case. It's still Lee. Yeah. So when Lee comes up from, you know, Sarasota, he does both on the same day.
Yeah.
So we split his travel.
So, is that something we want to talk about today?
Well, so I have some RFPs here that just gave me some. So really we have to go out if we want to look for some others. Now, one of the things that you all weren't here when we managed to get the old board to agree to giving him, I think it's a 4% increase every year. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute, you know, but I was outnumbered, you know. But I still have heartburn with that because that's a high cost of living, you know, increase. I mean, if you look at the wage index, you know, it's you know, 1.5, and he's getting 4%.
I don't have a problem with, there's a term, a real estate term, of cost of living based on inflation.
No, and like I said, you know, we had an old city manager who used to use the wage index, you know, as a marker, you know, that
right. Yeah.
Because the cost of living is always, you know, open. But I just think 4% is a little too deep, and that's where I fought with these people. I tried to get them, and I said, you know, I would agree with 2%, but I wouldn't agree with 4%, because to me that's huge. I mean, our pension plan has a 3% increase, COLA, and I mean, that's huge. I mean, there's a lot of people who jumped on it, but, you know, I had a lot of fights with city council and all, you know, when they were trying to cut the plan, their grandfather and people went away less than 5 years, and I'm like, they all reached the peak of their career and the peak of their salaries. It's like, you're not helping the plan by grandfathering them in, guaranteeing them the next 5 years we got a solid, you know, with the old numbers. So, you know, I had a lot of heartburn from our old city manager because I used to challenge him in front of his bosses. You know, he destroyed morale, union came in, it's like, you know, what are you doing for the employees? You know, so one of the things I'm thinking about, going off before I forget totally. I'm getting to that age too, buddy. So we have the fixed plan, and then we got the variable plan, and we merged them together. You remember, I had a lot of heartburn with that. But with us looking at lower percentage returns, what does that do for the variable? I mean, I know the variable is at the max. All employees are now given 5%. And to compensate for that, they gave a 2% raise to everybody to help those that were on the variable that they didn't see get hit. Now, those on the 401 or something, you know, they got to see, you know, a little bit of a raise. But with our mindset of how we're dealing with the bigger pension plan, how does that hurt the variable plan? It doesn't help it, I'm sure. You know, and I never asked that to Doug, but you understand mindset?
I mean, I'm seeing that. And I mean, I would get a better answer for Doug. You know, Doug will have a better answer than me. But if you're continuing, you know, Doug and I talked last time that we're going to look at the assumption rate maybe in another year and see if we need to lower it more than what it is. And the more you lower your assumption, the more investments I'm putting in here not to achieve a higher return, and then that's going to blow over. You're absolutely right to the variable plan, because the variable plan is about how much the fund actually earns.
Right.
And so if I'm targeting to earn less, of course it's going to earn less, right? I mean, so it's sort of like a circle, you know?
You weren't here when I was saying, you know, you're commingling the funds.
Yeah.
And the strategy So it's like I kept asking this, and then I was asking about tax base, and I beat up on them. I mean, they went and got, you know, some tax attorneys' opinions. Never really got anything formal, but it finally is just, it's like beating a dead horse. You give up on it after a while. I mean, but I look at these strategies, and I'm like, where are we helping any of them? And I think we have a whole lot less people on the variable plan. A bunch of people jumped ship when they froze the plan, more than they predicted, which is costing them, I think, 102% of payroll now. For, you know, people like me that have been in both plans, the old plan, you know, I have 19 years out, just shy of 1 year of being grandfathered in, but there are others that were like 1 month shy, you know, so I can understand the hard feelings about those type of people. But it's the variable plan, I think, has reached the maximum contribution from the employee because they wanted to share the load with the employee. And then I sit and I think about, well, strategies are slowly changing. So it just means that the city is going to keep on funding more and more money. I think they were ill-advised, and some of the predictions were off. I mean, you know. Bernie, I used to call it the Jim and Jim show, and I was kind of, you know, I wasn't reprimanded, but I was told it probably not right to call it that, but it was.
Well, and the fees that you found out that they were able to extract from the city alone is just...
So that was only my question, but I guess, you know, the city's got to deal with what they have to deal with. I mean,
is there any way to address that within this commingled portfolio by setting up a...
Well, because they're commingled funds, you can't. That's what I was screaming about at all. And I mean, so there's another part, and Jessica's going to feel this, is the fire department, their pension board's about to cave in. I mean, they don't have any new people that want to get in there, and that could be a problem, because then it's going to fall over to possibly the city to deal with that. Which means Jessica's going to pick up some more load. And remember, Alicia, she's starting to count down faster than I am. I mean, she's a year ahead of me. I'm telling her 3 years, but she's talking too. She might stay longer, but, you know, it all depends on things. But if there's more burden dumped on her, you know, what's...
What is the issue with fire and the board?
They just don't have any internal interest. I mean, I keep joking with Anthony, now that he's learning here, maybe he can go over there, and not to get rid of him, but, you know, to see what's going on with fire. They have younger people. And the younger people just don't understand.
Don't have the mindset about later on.
Right. Yeah, well, they don't understand it right now. Right. They're looking for today, and they're looking to keep up with the Joneses, and and they don't think about, you know, their future.
Well, and I'm sure they see folks like you who put in 19 years and then weren't grandfathered into something as maybe a disincentive to.
Right. No, I understand that, you know, because they're not even vested for 10 years.
And if I could use the word screwed, you know, they are maybe perceptive of the fact, look what happened. All of the people that were in this plan forever, and
you know, there's always rumors right around the city, you know, can the pension plan go away? And I mean, you know, it has been that there have been cities that go bankrupt. I mean, you know.
Social Security could go away.
I mean, I think it'd be a revolution.
Well,
you know,
you're right, right. It depends upon the bigness of the situation.
But I mean, you know, it's an issue that I think is going to fall onto, you know, our staff. And, you know, we have to be cognizant to it at least, you know. So I just want to throw that out there. OPD, I mean, I haven't seen anyone stepping up for them yet either, so... Their internal group is doing a lot of stuff on their own, as Randy used to do a lot on his own, but I don't think they can't co-mingle the pensions, so we don't have to worry about that. But I look at, you know, what it's going to inflict labor onto our administrative staff.
And where is the union in terms of...
Well, they have threatened to come try to take over, you know, the general employee pension plan, but they've never thrown any real guarantees on anything, and they still don't have a good participation. I mean, they have more members that have joined. I forget the exact numbers. Do you know it's 400 and something union? Do you know that?
I don't.
So there's over 50% of the employees are now in the union. But of that, I don't think they have but a low two-digit participation of people paying dues. So without having a greater participation, yeah. I don't think they want to endeavor. And the numbers that they talk about, returns if they took over the pension, I mean, most of these people are shocked because it's extremely low. And I tried to explain to them, IBEW is for the money. I mean, you know, they're not there for, you know...
Are they looking out for the employee, aren't they?
Yeah. The main employee.
I understand.
Okay, so no attorney's report.
So no attorney's report. I'm thinking we should do an RFP and go out and look for, you know.
But the cost of bringing a new person or a new attorney up to speed with the plan, you know what I'm saying?
So, you know, we have ordinances, and I mean, we have to go by the ordinance. So pretty much, you know, if you get a lawyer, he should be able to read the ordinance, and you know how I always say this, that it's open to interpretation, but a lawyer should read the ordinance, and he should understand kind of how it's written, and that's his set of guidelines. The rest is from Tallahassee, which is, you know, the legal part that he's supposed to be engaged in. There are some other attorneys in this state that are familiar with all the FARC rules and regs. I mean, the federal stuff, if they don't know that, there's no point in even, you know,
it would be nice if we could find someone from Central to North Florida versus...
It's not traveling as far. It's just like, you know, our actuary. I mean, you know, I have nothing against Doug or anything, but he's always been late. Now, he used to always blame it on Alicia, not giving numbers. Now, Alicia... The sad part is she has to wait for, you know, the finance people to give her numbers before she could send them. And then we used to complain about, you know, the Bank of New York. Well, they're gone.
Yeah.
Okay, so we can't use them as an excuse anymore. And Alicia has really been with Jessica helping. I mean, they're getting their numbers into Doug on time, but he's like, well, it's so convoluted. You know, you got your variable, you got your fixed. I need extra time to figure it out. And it's like, okay, I know what we're doing is... the only one in Florida doing this. But he's been doing it long enough, you wouldn't think that he could use it as an excuse anymore. And it's sad. I mean, we have this with both of them. I mean, our actuary and our attorney, Alicia, will call out and ask them for some help or send them an email. And until I call them and start, you know, really bullying them around, do we get timely results? and I don't think that's the way it's supposed to be. So that's why I said that we should start doing evaluation reports. I mean, Rose steps up and offers stuff if she sees it. If Elisa sends something to Rose, I mean, she gets an instant reply. She would always get an A plus, you know. But I mean, you know, Glee, I don't quite feel the same way. And Doug is always, you know, producing behind the schedule, which affects a lot of things.
And you would think that we would have a succession plan.
Well, Lee thinks he's going to ride it out until he passes away, you know. It's, and then
what
he's
about
not going to care.
Well,
you heard the last part of my statement, right? That he doesn't care.
Yeah.
So before you do this, should you do the evaluation and present it in a tactful manner?
So on the side, I've already asked Jessica and Alicia to go out to other cities and find out who they're using for attorneys, how much they're paying. I mean, so they've done this extra legwork for us in advance. So we already have, you know, pretty much backup when we're ready to discuss it. I just, you know, some stuff I can engage with them on the side until we get to be as a board that would, you know, when we make real definitive decisions, like let's do an RFP. That has to be all of us. But, you know, asking them to go research other cities, find out other attorneys, find out their fees, find out if other cities do performance evaluations, if the people are performing it.
Do we have that info back already?
Yeah, mostly all of
it. Can that be shared?
Yes.
With the individual board member?
Yeah, we were still waiting on a few cities to get back with us if they haven't. So it's not completely, it's not 100%.
But then once you have it, you'll disseminate it to all of us.
Well, we don't know if we'll ever get complete. I mean, some cities, you know, unless you absolutely do a, you know,
public record request,
yeah. And then they can drag a little bit, but, you know, it's. So they've been doing it. I mean,
how many do we have feedback from?
I would say probably about 8 to 10.
That's enough. That's a good sample.
We have a decent sampling.
Yeah.
But like I said, you know, some of this can't be made decisions without a board, you know, quorum. Whereas some of it, I just asked them to go do it because I knew that I was going to introduce this to us. And like I said, I can justify it that, you know, we get some reports that aren't on time, that we have to have an emergency, you know, meeting, which costs us additional money.
Yeah.
Because Lee wants to be there, and I mean, you know, Lee's not getting chump change anymore, you know, his increase, and Rose, you know, she'll say, well, you know, I don't need to be there for this, and if you want, I can be by the phone, but, you know, it's like, it's not necessary, and you saw when she took her little mini sabbatical, I mean, somebody else came in who was fully up to speed. There was no learning curve. And those, to me, are huge things. I mean, especially, you hear me. We're always asked.
Right, but I have
the fees and...
Right, but I have a problem with, you know, us not letting them know that we're not 100% satisfied.
Right, so that's the reason for the evaluation report.
Right, but we're always going
to
do that.
But to do an RFP is just to go find, you know, that's just a request for, you know, for a proposal on pricing and information. It's, what are you going to do? What's the worst? You're going to hurt their feelings?
I think you told me.
Maybe that,
though,
yeah. I told Lee. And I believe I told Doug.
We're paying.
Well, you know, the bottom line is we pay this money. And, you know, our fiduciary responsibility is to the plan. It's not to the people, but it's to the plan. And are we doing justice to the plan by once in a while doing a sanity check? I mean,
performance and cost.
You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what do we pay Lee on an annual basis?
I don't have that information, but I can get it.
It runs.
Well,
is it an hourly rate?
Yes. And like I said, we share with OPD, so we pay for him to drive up here from Sarasota, which is, you know, 2.5 hours or so. And then there's his lunch break. And I don't know if that's, you know, given to us or charged a little bit of his time from when he leaves home till he gets back. And then OPD picks up the afternoon and his drive back. But, I mean, you know, it's when you start thinking that someone commuting from Sarasota, I drive like a banshee and I can do it in 2.5 hours. I mean, you know, there's, you know, he's charging $300 an hour and it's 3 hours of travel time. Are we paying him $900 to get in his Mercedes and drive up here?
Four times a year.
I think we did six times last year. We had two extra meetings, you know. It's, and then there's this time while he sits here for the 3 hours also.
Right. And then, of course, there's the time
and
the office.
Yeah, then when he does the office work, you know, for contracts for new money managers and, you know, things like that. I'm not sure if he's as bad as, like, the city attorney charges when we call. First thing he does is he starts to stopwatch. Okay. And then he always rounds up.
Well, that's it. It's a six-minute interview.
So I just think that, you know, our fiduciary responsibility is to do a sanity check.
I agree.
And I just wanted to run that by everybody and see what you all think about that.
Yeah, there's not too many areas where, in business where you don't do that, you know?
Yeah.
I know within purchasing, we always go pretty much every year out and find out what our deal is. And
so a motion to maybe do some RFPs and maybe start introducing evaluation, you know, reports on all three. I mean, you know, it's the money managers we pretty much watch all the time, but our advisor, I mean, she's here, she hears me saying right in front of her, but you know, it's like, let's tell her how she's doing. And tell her if, you know, if she's not meeting our expectations, just like, you know, Lee and Doug. And Doug, I've already told him, I'm like, dude, you are not, you know, fulfilling my expectations, which is getting stuff on time. You're always asking for an extra month. So, now that we talked, does anyone want to make a motion? Or do you just want to table it?
I've hogged the flow with motions. I think an evaluation process and then presenting an evaluation after should be done first.
Right.
Then, you know, then see how, because if I'm a vendor, right, I want to know that people are happy with me. And give me a chance to improve my service or improve my response rate or whatever.
Before you go to the request for proposal.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
So right now it's just automatic, aren't you? Every year he just...
Right.
4% every year.
There's no
performance checks, no...
Ask Rose, would you want to all of a sudden hear that we're out shopping for a new consultant? Or would you want to know, hey, we're not...
Yeah, and I've had clients before say, hey... You know, this stuff, we're not happy with this thing or whatever, and you know, and I've said, absolutely, tell me. I want to know so I can fix it.
Can we do that? We're shopping and then set that RFP for next.
That's what we're here to talk about. I mean, you know, so we get 4% every year. Rose, how many times have you asked for a raise for the company?
Once.
In my tenure. Come think of it.
Yes.
You know, a year or
but that's what, yeah, really,
right.
You know,
over that period of time.
Otherwise, it's flat.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess.
So someone has made the motion now to go ahead?
No, nobody's made a motion. We're just having, you know, a conversation. And then we need a motion if we're going to.
I've got a piece of place it. No.
Well, then step on it. Do you want to make the motion or you just want to let it sit?
I prefer an evaluation in a presentation.
Do we need a motion for that? That's where I thought we...
Well, so, no, really for an evaluation, I mean, basically...
Just a meeting of the minds here at the board?
Well, or just so to be the proxy in between and each one of us. I'd like to keep it going, because I started this two meetings ago, and it's not gone anywhere. I'm going to ask her to get some of the questions in the evaluation, you know, checklist, and start sending them out to each one of you. Remember, don't reply all. Remember, you all have a city email site.
Right.
And let's start working on some questions, and I'm hoping maybe we can formulate something by next meeting that we can all vote on, that this is what we agree on for each one of our three that we want to, you know, do report cards on.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to keep it moving. I think that it's important to the pension itself, the plan, that once in a while we check. And I think also, you know, to our advisor, our attorney, to let them know what we think.
Right.
In a formal way. I can tell Rose all the time she's doing an awesome job.
Right.
but, you know, let's do it formal.
So that requires no...
No, I...
You have a meeting of the minds here from the board to go...
So Jessica can start, you know, formulating, and I'll work with her, and, you know, she'll come up with some, you know, questions for each one, the actuary, the attorney, the advisor, and she'll email them to you, and I'd like you all to, you know, just read them and you know, critique them.
Sure. And then...
And maybe by next meeting, we will have a real set of questions for each one of them, and then we can vote on them, and...
Vote on the construction of that...
Yeah, what we actually think is going to be that report card for each one, I mean, because they're uniquely different.
Okay, I want to make sure I understand this now. We're going to go create these questionnaire, which will, in essence, the bottom line will be a report card.
Right.
And once we have those report cards constructed, the questionnaires, we'll vote as to whether we accept that format,
right,
or...
Correct.
Okay, and then, after we accept those formats, then we will go ahead and complete the evaluation. And then based upon those evaluations, we will again talk about, okay...
So do you see we're already 9 months out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the bottom line to this is then, we would then say, well, it looks like maybe we need to...
Right.
You know, do something with regard to the actuary, or do something with regard to... And when are we communicating with the actuary, and when are we communicating with the attorney, right, that they're on the hot seat? At what point, after these questionnaires are analyzed?
So they've all been told.
They know already.
They already, yeah, know that this is going to happen.
Just verbally by you, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You said, I'm not happy with, yeah, right, your response rate. I'm not happy.
Well, when Doug was here, I told him that too. You know, so it's recorded. Lee, it's recorded.
If you don't let me be the one.
No, well, you know, it's a majority vote here where we go. I'm just saying, you know, it's like I asked Jessica and, you know, and Alicia to go out and get other cities to get, you know, some facts. So if next meeting you say, hey, I want to see the facts, I'm just thinking if we do the RFP at the same time, at least then we have some other numbers too. So if we sit down as a group and have a meeting, I mean, maybe it'd be a separate meeting. We don't need to include anyone but us,
yeah,
and obviously in this room to record it, but let's start putting it all together and decide if we're going down the right path or if we just need to continue the way we're going. I mean, but I think we owe it to the plan to do a sanity check.
There's also a best practice of, you know, not every, you don't have to do it every 5 years or whatever, but to do RFPs to just price the market and make sure you feel like you're in. If you wanted to do something, I don't mind. I mean, if you wanted to issue RFPs for all three of us, just so you have those on file, I mean, I don't have a problem with that, just so that you have it to the market and you issue all three. I mean, I can give you
a
draft
RFP.
Yeah,
I'm not opposed to, I guess, having market...
Fair market
information.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying.
And then you don't have to interview. Like, a lot of cities, what they do is they get the art, like, City of Tallahassee did this, where consultants to them, too. They had RFPs in, and even when they did a vendor for their 457, they did it. They brought in all the information, they did scoring, and if they felt like the presentation was going to be 10 points, but the winner was way above that, you know what I mean? They didn't interview people.
Right.
They just decided, you know, we can do a score sheet, and we think this firm, and they didn't have to interview people, they just went with it. So if you get the attorney one in, whatever, and you feel like you want to do interviews, you can, but if you don't, and you look at the pricing, and you look at it, you don't have to interview, you can award without interviewing finalists.
So I'll make a motion.
Okay,
then. All right. I'll make a motion that we do an RFP for all three vendors.
Right.
Just to get market information.
Okay. I second that motion.
All right. All those for it? All right. Awesome.
And you can call it an RFI if you want to, and you can make decisions off of that, like a request for information versus
right.
request for proposal, and that leaves it more open
yeah,
for you.
Yeah.
All right, so let's move on real quick, because we're running out of time. The summary plan, you were all here for it. So I have a draft, but I need a motion to accept it, I guess.
Do you find it to be what it should be?
Well, it's what he brought on. I mean, it's...
He's the attorney for the plan.
He's the attorney for the plan.
That is his job.
That's what we pay.
I move that we accept the draft of the summary plan description as presented by council.
A second.
All those for?
Aye.
Aye. Say something so the microphone picks it up.
Aye.
All right. The minutes? Have you seen them?
Yeah.
I wasn't there, but they looked okay to me, but...
Well, for somebody that wasn't there...
Hey!
That's pretty good. Yeah, I read them. Tony, we'll give you...
Let's give Tony a chance.
Make a motion to accept the records.
Yeah.
Or the minutes.
I'll second.
All right. Okay, then we can sign them.
Yeah.
You're not secretary, are you?
And I was removed from that without even notice.
See what happens when I take...
I was literally...
I missed one meeting. You get a promotion and a demotion.
How I'm saying, sir.
Put it on your report card.
You said there was an... So, you know, continued education is, you know...
Is that the thing down in... No, oh, that's the FDP. Yeah.
Yeah, turn on the...
And I already got... Did I mention it to you two to make sure I'm...
Anthony said you're signing them up for January?
Yes.
I've been this year.
You've been this year.
Looks like I got to bring my uniform with me, though.
January?
I don't know. You don't...
Is that dress code?
I don't think you...
I got a bright flashlight.
I like the...
Don't want to be embarrassed.
No, it's business casual.
Okay.
Did you...
I've seen a few show up with shorts and flip-flops, just so you know.
Oh, no, auditing.
You'd be as comfortable as you want.
Okay, you did not... You weren't in the CPPT.
No helmet.
I am not going to do...
No helmet.
I am not going to...
Oh, okay. I was going to say, you... The requirement is only to be at the...
I am not there.
Right, so I am not... Well, I'm certifiable, but I'm not certified.
You are.
But I always go to, you know, other things. It's just continued education, that's all they ask. All right, so that's all we have so far is Anthony for January. All right, do we have anything else? What's this from Long Wharf?
This is for information.
And from Foster and Foster, it's just the numbers. All right. I guess we can adjourn this meeting.
All right.